Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on October the 14th, 2015. I am Wire Ruler of Time, here with Rolo T for a big episode of Weekly Manga Recap. How's it going, man?
I'm doing very well, Nick. I would like to say, though, we can't... This is normally the part where I do, like, an anecdote or some wacky topic that springs up, and we tangent off of it for, like, 30 minutes. We don't have time for that, Nick, because the last time we talked about an Urasawa title, it went on for, like, an hour and a half.
Something along those lines, yes. Yeah, so we have to power through it, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have time for that this week, Nick, because I feel like if we do, we'll run right up against 3 hours, and I refuse to be the weekly manga podcast that does 3 hours worth of content each week. I just can't. I don't think I could live with myself.
Okay, and with full acknowledgement of how unusual we are acting in terms of let's just get straight to business, well, let's just get straight to business. We're talking about Monster this week. One of Naoki Urasawa's, I guess, three most famous manga they did. Probably his single most famous out of them, I think.
It's between that and 20th Century Boys. 20th Century Boys had a live-action series of movies, mm-hmm. So maybe that might give it a little bit more. But this is the only one that has, I think, a notable anime to it. I don't think people got an anime. And it's probably the most popular one here because... little known fact, this series was actually at one point going to be pitched, was in development rather, to be a series on HBO with Guillermo del Toro directing it.
I can totally see that.
Yeah. Eventually it just kind of fell apart, but that's something that I greatly wish had happened.
So what is this Monster series? It's ran in the mid-90s through 2001, and basically... the story starts off with this Japanese doctor in Germany. He's like the one Japanese character in the whole series, basically. There are like a few one-off characters that get introduced, but other than that, just like, no, it's just him, basically.
I am being told that Master Keaton had an anime, so that's another one he had, but I don't think that...
It's not nearly as big.
Yeah.
His name is Kenzo Tenma. And he is this incredibly skilled surgeon. He's on the up and up. He is engaged to the daughter of, like, the hospital director or something like that. I forget what the guy's exact position is. His life looks awesome. But then one day, this poor woman, you know, comes to him complaining that he had operated on this high-ranking politician rather than her labor husband. And so Tenma has this very big crisis of conscience because he's just been going along with doing what the hospital wants him to do. And he realizes, well, all lives should be treated equally. So the next time that someone comes to him with a patient, he refuses to leave to go and work on some political person instead. And instead, he saves this 10-year-old boy's life by removing a bullet from his brain. Miraculously saves his life. And... But, of course, because he disobeyed the hospital's wishes, basically he loses all of his career momentum. He is told, oh, you're never going to, you know, rise from anything other than just being one of our awesome doctors. Which, even so, it's a pretty good salary you can have right there. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, his fiance Ava, reveals that she only was interested in him because he was going to rise up in the world and... She would make a trophy wife for him and so on and so forth. So she leaves him. His life seemingly left in shambles. So at one time while he's looking over the boy who's still comatose, he's like, oh, those people are awful and I wish that they would just die. A few days later, they wind up dead. And the boy has escaped along with his twin sister. And then it turns out, yes, that boy had committed the murders. As 8 years later, he returns and he is this... The worst serial killer in the whole world, and the most amazing, can-get-away-with-anything person ever, basically. And that boy's name is Johann Liebert, and he is the monster of the series, the antagonist. Basically, he is seemingly the devil in human form, such as his influence and his charisma and his otherworldliness. Despite this,
he's
otherwise
very
being...
frequently compared to the Antichrist.
It's actually a very... grounded series, but he just has this tremendous influence over people, and he is so frightening to everyone that he meets that, it seems as though he's the devil, basically.
And his path even starts to mirror some of the scripture that follows the story of the Antichrist. Strangely enough, Nick, 13 years of Catholic school, don't know a lot about the Antichrist. I feel like they taught us everything we need to be warriors of Christ, except the weaknesses of our enemy.
How to recognize the person we're fighting against.
Except the strengths and weaknesses of our enemy. Should we have to actually engage him? I don't know shit about how to beat the Antichrist.
You'd be like, I am a soldier of God, and you come across Johann, he's like, you actually want to kill yourself, and you're like, you're right, then!
I'm like, wait, how do I defend myself against this? Think back to what you learned in Catholic school. Every prayer is a powerful weapon. Damn it, it's nothing but hymns! Fuck! So worthless.
You can't stop me, Johann, I've got a whole lifetime worth of guilt to use against you.
He's like, oh, you're so, this is so easy. You're already depressive and guilt-ridden. I don't even need to manipulate you in anything. I'm just like, you're right. You'll be over here crying.
You know what would make you feel better? If you killed all of my enemies for me. Really? Yeah, you can trust me. Totally.
I'll totally be your friend. Will you?
Yeah.
Are you just joshing me? Because I've seen you kill a lot of your other friends. I will definitely won't kill you.
Like, dude, come on.
Thanks, Johann.
Come on, look at how pretty I am. Oh, you're right.
Like, and you are wearing that very attractive wig, so.
I had heard a fair amount about this series, mostly because Johann has got a tremendous reputation as being a very effective manga villain. I believe years and years ago, Jesu Otaku named him her top anime villain. He shows up as a lot of people's favorite villains in general because this is such a famous and well-regarded series, and Johann's got this influence over basically everything that happens. And surprisingly enough, he doesn't show up in a tremendous amount of it, but his influence is everywhere.
Yeah, his presence is basically mentioned from chapter one on, so...
And I should go ahead and say that we covered this series basically on the recommendation for doing it for Halloween month. I did not really find this series to be scary.
Like, it's definitely not a scary series in any way, shape, or form. It's maybe a thriller at points.
I would call it a horror series, maybe, because, I mean, it deals with some very dark stuff. A lot of people die. There is a serial killer as one of the main characters, and so on and so forth. But more than anything, I just kind of felt... The most I felt was if a character was introduced and you were obviously meant to feel, you know, connected to them in some way, it was just this kind of sense of dread. It was like, oh, wow, this person might die. In fact, they probably will.
It's like, are they Tenma or one of his, like, two close friends? About 90% chance this character is going to get killed.
And it's actually the series balances death actually very effectively. It's not like, oh, everyone's going to die if they encounter Johann or something like that. So it keeps you on your toes in terms of whom he sees fit to, I guess not even really to spare, but to dispose of after they've outlived their usefulness to him, basically. He doesn't feel like he has to kill everyone. He just... At least for right now.
He knows the time he will anyway.
Right, so sometimes they encounter him and they end up being okay by the end of it. He might ruin their life in some other way. They might, I don't know, end up in jail. Or they may feel compelled to kill themselves later on because he's super scary.
He does some horrible things to people. I don't want to jump too quickly into like just Johann's stuff, but I will just say his acts... are what give this series its darkest tone. Because he himself is essentially quintessential evil. He is almost evil personified. Not to the extent that like a character like Six was from Ajin Tate Nagami Nero, who was more or less just like, oh no, I'm concentrated evil just passed from generation to the point where I'm now superhuman evil. But Johann is essentially just this... void of nothing but nihilism and apathy and murder. He is nothing but those thoughts, really. And whenever you see a character, you're like, I've grown attached to this. Seeing them interact with me, like, oh god, no.
Please don't die.
He's going to kill this person, Nick. And it's you get that dread from it. So it's not like a scary series. Like, you wouldn't go and see this movie in a theater, even though it actually has a lot of similarity, I feel like, to the Halloween series. With, like, Jamie Lee Curtis as, you know, Nina and the Mike Myers role with Johann, just as serial killer who's, like, constantly chasing after his sister. But it's disturbing in a different way that I do feel fits the horror, or at least darker tone that this month tries to set up at certain points.
Mm-hmm.
It's, by and large, I feel an excellent series. I read this series back originally in, I feel like it was like 2010, 2011, somewhere around that time.
Okay.
So it's been a while since I read it. I read most of the series catching back up on it. I wasn't able to catch up on every little bit of it, but I read a good portion of it to kind of refamiliarize myself with a lot of the characters. And it is, by and large, a classic example of Urasawa's work. It's a long, epic story that is peppered with a lot of very small stories centered around characters who are oftentimes kind of self-enclosed to these moments. You'll get a 2-chapter-long little arc, almost, where we'll meet some character, we'll get their story, at the end of it, maybe you learn a lesson, maybe that character dies, you know, it changes based on the thing, but there are a lot of very sympathetic, a lot of very sad, a lot of very hopeful stories, despite the fact that the series is about essentially an antichrist. It's a very hopeful series in that same regard, but you get a lot of these very short stories that, for another author, might come off distracting, and sometimes even in this they do, but they might come off cheesy or things like that. But Urasawa has such an effectiveness at writing those characters, and almost every time I get invested and I get really, you know, like, oh, what a great scene, I'm like, oh no, not this person too. It's a tough balancing act at times, I feel.
There are times when it feels like Urasawa just kind of felt like doing a story about one type of character, you know, like a spy, mm-hmm. or, you know, a poor town's doctor or something like that. Because it does kind of jump around like that. But overall, you do feel as if Tenma and Johan and Johan's sister Nina and Agent Lunge and all the very important characters are all kind of constantly moving towards the conclusion.
Yes.
So even though there are these little stops along the way, they do build towards this eventual end goal, which ends up, the series really feels more at times like a mystery than it does a full-on slasher or horror story or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, basically, you don't get all the answers, but we'll talk about that towards the end.
Yeah. And I will say that if you have seen, if you've read, rather, or I guess if you've seen 20th Century Boys, the movies, Monster has a lot of similar themes and concepts to that. In fact, a big one is having a mysterious antagonist whose identity has essentially vanished through history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I was reading Monster, I was like, were Johan and Friend that similar that I like, didn't read and like, catch it the first time through?
Yeah, like, but Johan's explanation is way more satisfying than Friend, so...
Johan doesn't need to go into a virtual reality things.
It was just this one kid, so, you know, whatever.
And Johan's actually makes sense. I will say, I actually do enjoy reading back. I wasn't able to get through every bit of it to explain every last detail again. I think I missed the bit about the Red Room thing, or Red Mansion, whatever that red thing was.
Oh, God, that's...
I had to kind of refresh myself through that through a couple of ancillary materials, but for the most part, I was, like, reading through it again. I was like, oh, I kind of like where they went with Johan, because what's interesting is you don't quite get an answer at the start as to what Johan is. You find out relatively quickly he was a kid who was involved in this program called the Kinderheim 511, which was, like, an orphanage where Germans were essentially trying to create, like, a super soldier who would be remorseless killing, and they succeeded in the worst way possible.
They were basically trying to create a super Hitler.
Yes. And what essentially happened is from that, Johan kind of emerged and orchestrated a grand closing of Kinderheim 511 when he convinced everybody in the orphanage, including the instructors, to kill each other. And watched happily as it happened, you know, like, from a giant throne. So you get this idea when you meet one of the instructors, he kind of explains, like, no, children must be nurtured, because that is what really brings it into them. You know, it's the idea of nurture versus nature. What made Johan evil? But then, after that, the guy also says, like, no, Johan was different. He was different from anywhere else. He would sit on this chair and talk about how he'll be the last one alive, and how he's just pouring gasoline on these fires of humanity that will burn and kill each other. So you get this idea, like, was Johan always evil? Did this program make him evil? You know, like, everyone, when they see him or talk about him, they talk like he's evil. And not in, like, even a religious sense, because I don't think religion really even comes up in this series very much. Just the sense of he is just concentrated evil. Whenever you see a crime scene of him, it's devoid of any emotion at all. It's just pure, ruthless kill. And, like, just stuff done in the sides to make it look like, oh, no, it was just a robbery. Like, no, this guy just fucking kills. And I like that it creates this dynamic between him and Tenma, very similar to kind of like a Batman Joker or a Legato Vash, where it's like Tenma is this character who is devoting himself to stopping Johan because he feels responsible as a doctor, and this is a common doctor archetype, I feel like, in fiction. He needs to fix this problem he's created.
Right.
Johan would love that more than anything. In fact, anytime Johan sees Tenma, he does the signature point to the head thing. Basically, encouraging, killing. Because if he does that, then Johan wins. Because that's his one thing he wants to prove. He believes all of humanity can be corrupted and brought into being horrible, horrible monsters like he is. And Tenma is the one person that he believes is beyond that. And he wants to prove, like, no, you're also can be just as much of a monster as I am. So go ahead, kill me, shoot me in the head, and see what happens. And everybody will be devoured by the monster inside.
And we should talk about Tenma because he is an incredibly important character. I mean, he's the protagonist, but I mean, he plays an integral role in fleshing out the theme of the series. But one of the things that's also very important is the fact that Johan has a twin sister, Nina. And so going to that whole nature versus nurture thing that you talked about, of course you have Nina, who is a good guy in the series. She is probably the secondary protagonist.
Yes.
And she is trying to find Johan also to try and kill him because she realizes that he's evil and he needs to be stopped. And once she basically regains these memories of her childhood, which have been repressed, like, she was actually the one to shoot Johan in the head. And it was because Johan had killed their foster parents and he basically said, come on, you should shoot me in the head now. Which basically implies that Johan has always been trying to find the right people to kill him. And he just somehow knows after meeting someone whether or not they're the one who is worthy to be corrupted by him, basically to have the monster inside of him passed on. And basically the only two in the series that he deems worthy in the present are Tenma and Nina. And but the fact that she is, you know, his identical twin, and throughout the series you learn more and more that a lot of the stuff that Johan went through, she went through as well. And in fact, she actually went through some things that Johan did not. And so she freaks out at a few points because she thinks, is the monster inside of Johan also inside of me? Am I also evil? And so on and so forth. And that struggle between good and evil is very well captured with her because she's so close to Johan. The fact that they're twins, they came from such similar scenarios. And of course you would think that, because of how awful Johan is. And then there's Tenma, who is a fucking angel, basically.
He is. He's
pretty badass, though.
He is. It's at the start of the series, he's kind of a doormat and very trusting and naive. But that's kind of where his flaws stop, because other than that, he's an incredibly selfless person. He's ridiculously skilled. I guess maybe he's not particularly handsome at the start. He seemed kind of ugly to me, but, you know, I'm judge.
But then he grew out his hair and he got that 5 o'clock shadow.
Put on that badass coat. But he is this very good-natured person, and he believes firmly in the idea every life is created equally. You know, it's the lesson he feels he learned after saving that young boy and, you know, doing it at the cost of essentially his future. So he, at one point, runs into somebody who's, it's like basically the second or third chapter, he runs into somebody who's like a serial killer, or no, just a thief, actually, I believe.
Yeah.
Adolf Junkers. And he basically kind of like manages to talk, find out about this guy's life, find out about, like, he's not actually a bad guy, goes out of his way to basically pick up a gift to help this guy, and then, lo and behold, that leads into Johan showing up, Tenma running into him, and this whole dynamic coming about.
He actually convinces Adolf that to reveal who the conspirator is, who of course is Johan, because he's just, you know, eventually gets Adolf to remember the good side of him. And that's what Tenma does, is he makes people realize the best parts of themselves. As opposed to Johan, who makes people realize the worst parts of themselves and act on those instead.
And then what happens, Johan meets him, basically reveals himself, and he almost looks towards Tenma as almost like a father figure at certain points. Mm-hmm. Because he thanks him for, like, giving me life, and he'll leave him messages around the world, like, you know, look at me, the monster inside has grown this big! And he, you know, he kills this guy, Adolf, and basically sets Tenma on this path of him constantly going on this long journey of questioning his devotion against his ideal. Can he make this decision to actually kill Johan to put an end to what he created if it costs him everything he holds dear? And that's, you know, it's something you see in a lot of series, but it's, I feel it's one of the most effectively told versions of it in this story, because I compared it earlier to like a Batman Joker scenario. There's, you know, that like long Reddit post that guy explains, like, why can't Joker or Batman just kill Joker? And, you know, like, explain the dichotomy of their relationship. And a lot of the same parallels are here, but the thing that works is that this has an ending. You know, Batman versus Joker is never really going to have an ending, but this one does. So you actually do get a conclusion to it, and I, you know, we won't get into the exact follow-up of that, but I feel it helps a lot to kind of get answers to a lot of those questions, and then just follow Tenma on his path as he starts to get further and further down the path of, like, well, can I always, you know, how close does he get towards making this decision, and will he ultimately go through with it? What sacrifices will he make along the way?
You know, and the thing is, he never sacrifices that most important part of himself, at the very least, up until you get to a certain point where he's resolved that he's got to kill Johan, because his instinct as a doctor kicks in even at times where it's incredibly inconvenient for him. Like, you know, this guy who has just tried to kill him is, like, mortally wounded, and Tenma will do everything he can to save that person's life because he's a doctor, and all human lives deserve to be treated equally and saved if possible. Of course, then he has to go off into the jungle and find this ex-veteran so that he can learn how to you know, use firearms and kill Johan, but the guy also has a little girl whose mother he killed during a war, and so he adopted her. And Tenma takes some time out of his training every now and then to help them get closer as a family.
Yeah.
And it's like, God, dude, how perfect are you?
Those are one of those little stories, too. Like, it's a character here, like, it ties into the overall, one of the overall themes of the story of people who commit crimes can be redeemed. Everyone deserves that chance. Because it's a soldier who killed somebody, and, you know, the daughter of the person he killed, eventually, small spoiler to that, you know, two-chapter story, grows to finally accept him and not hate him for it. It's, you know, one of the themes of the series, but there's so many, like, really great little short stories like that. One of them being, it's coming right upon sort of like the midway climax of the series. I sort of look at the series as almost like two parts, the first one being the library in Munich, and the second one obviously being the end of the series.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Leading up to that scene in Munich, there is a scene where Tenma is in the woods and he's basically getting ready, sort of, you know, planning things out for killing Johan in the woods. And then this old guy runs up to him and is like, oh, hey, seen you around here a couple times. Catch you around. And the next time Tenma goes into the woods to see him, he finds the old guy, like, stumbled over on the ground. He's like, oh, sorry, I lost my step and been apologizing to these woods for 30 years or whatever. And he goes on to explain, yeah, he tells it like a story, like as though it's not him, even though I feel like everybody, like Tenma was like, it's fucking you. You don't have to, you can stop using the second person, third person now. But he tells a story like, there was a soldier in, I don't know if it's specifically Hitler's army, but I believe it was Hitler's army.
Because he killed Jews.
Yeah, he was asked to kill a foreign soldier, and he went out into these woods. I skipped the part that this guy also was in the woods all the time, and he'd hold in his arm and birds would come. Then he went into the war, was asked to kill this foreigner, goes out into the woods to find him, finds the guy, finds out it's not a foreign soldier at all, it's just a foreigner, but per his orders, shoots and kills the guy. And ever since then, the birds would never return to him, and he's been coming to this forest every single day for the past 30 years, apologizing to it. And
hoping that one day the birds will come back and forgive me. And then one of the birds fucking lands on Tenma's arm.
Yeah. But it has this poetic ending, though, where the guy's like, oh, finally, don't you worry. No more blood will be spilled in these woods.
And like, God damn it! This was the perfect shot to kill Johan!
But it is, it's like this great little story that like ties to fit this theme, because it's this really interesting dynamic of trying to protect one's innocence. Because you've ever seen that story before of like, no, I can't let you kill this person, because once you do it, you can't go back. What's cool in this is there's two characters doing that for each other, because Nina and Tenma both don't want one another to kill Johan. They prefer themselves to be the one to do it, to kind of spare the other one. So you just get these scenes where they run into each other, and he's like, no, don't shoot Nina! No, I'm going to shoot him! He's like, no, don't! It's really cool that way, though, I like.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Tenma feels as if he's got to shoulder that burden, but Nina's like, no, you know, Johan's my twin brother. I should be the one to be tasked with that burden. And we should not actually forget to mention that during the course of this whole series, Tenma is on the run from the law because everyone thinks that the people that Johan has killed have actually been killed by Tenma. And in fact, one of the main antagonists through the series is basically a federal police agent, Inspector, I guess, Lunge? It's spelled Lunge. Like Lunge. I'm not sure if it's actually pronounced that way.
Because like
he's Lunge. Whatever. He's German. I'm just going to say
feel like I really want to get opinions from our German readers on this series, too, because I feel like this is one of the only times I've seen like German culture expressed in a manga form outside of
the Quincy's with their bullshit names, yeah. There ain't no na 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 Najikupin.
I feel like there's names just as hard to pronounce, though.
There are a few that are pretty difficult. So Inspector Lunge, who is at first portrayed basically as this robot, he has this quirk where whenever he gets some data, he'll mime punching keys on the keyboard so that he can enter it into his mind, and then when he needs to pull it up later, he does the same thing. One or two times through the series says, oh, the computer inside my brain, or something like that. He's such a weird character in that respect. But the thing about him is that he is convinced, because there is no trace that Johan actually exists, he's convinced that Johan is like this alternate persona that Tenma has crafted, that Tenma is actually like schizophrenic, has, you know, multiple personality disorder. And so he's pursuing this fake personality while actually performing the killings. So Lunge is convinced of this. He pursues Tenma through the whole series almost. And he's a very kind of almost one-note character, but there's this note of tragedy to him because he is so obsessed with his work, and particularly with capturing Tenma, that like Tenma, he kind of loses everything. His family leaves him. He gets, you know, demoted during his job. He gets like all of his cases taken away from him because
he's so relentless and everything, that his relentlessness actually causes a culprit to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it just weighs. So it doesn't weigh on him at all. He's just like to the next case. Trying to solve Tenma. That's the only thing that seems to give him any kind of emotional satisfaction.
And it's a really creepy emotional satisfaction, because at one point he basically lays a trap for Tenma. He comes across this crime scene where someone basically has followed Johan's MO, but they've done a poor job of it. And Lunge basically tells the guy he knows has actually done it, hey, you didn't commit this crime. And he's like, yeah, no, you didn't commit this crime. Understand? And he tells the media to say, oh yeah, it was all the killer, you know, who's been doing this and so on and so forth, knowing that because Tenma will hear about it, he'll show up at that scene, and so Lunge lays a trap for him, which is actually a really cool sequence. But Lunge manages to finally catch him, and they have this struggle. Lunge gets mortally wounded, and Tenma saves his life, and Lunge still thinks that Tenma's the killer, but the only reaction he has when people find him and are, you know, patching him up and stuff is just like, oh, this is the most fun case I've ever been on. He's so fucking psychotic.
There's a lot of characters in the series who are very emotionally off. You know, you have him, You have Johan, who barely seems to express... There's only one moment in this series where he seems to express any kind of emotion when he's doing awful things, and it's such a sad moment, too, with Richard Braun, the private eye, who gives with the alcohol.
I thought he was faking all that, though.
He seems to have, in the last moment, a lot of excitement when he basically just brings that guy back to rock.
Yeah, that poor guy. I feel so bad for him.
It's rough. But there's also, and this is my favorite character in the series, Grimmer, who's a character
we fucking love Grimmer.
We only meet him about halfway through the series, and for a little bit he actually becomes like the protagonist of the story. For like two volumes, he becomes like the main character you follow, and then he kind of appears sporadically. But he is such a great character. But he also himself, he's this guy with a big smile, he's super friendly, he's great. And then you quickly come to find out that he himself also has these weird emotional hang-ups, and that everything we're kind of seeing from him are all facsimiles. You know, he himself doesn't actually feel these emotions anymore. And it's such a powerful kind of thing. We'll follow that character on his journey. I almost wish we had like 5 episodes to dedicate to fucking Monster, because I go on for like an hour about how much Grimmer...
Well, because there's so many different characters, and despite the fact that you don't have too much time with each single one of them, there's so much depth in the short amount of time that they're, you know, featured, and they're all so well executed. Even fucking Eva, Tenma's ex-fiance, who basically just becomes this alcoholic gold digger who eventually runs out of men to seduce and then divorce so that she gets money from them, and is just left this drunken waste. She's one of the more interesting characters in the series as well, because she has such complicated feelings towards Tenma. She wants to ruin his life, but she's still in love with him, and she wants to save him, and so on and so forth. And she gets into this situation that she really should not be involved in, because she's way out of her depth. And despite the fact that she acts like such an awful person to so many people, somehow they still get connected to her and want to save her. And by the third or so person who that happens to, you're just kind of like, oh yeah, I really hope she doesn't die. I hope that this guy who fell in love with her saves her and they go and have kids together or something.
She's also one of the more interesting characters, because it's that she's sort of this, at the start, she's a bitch, almost like a throwaway kind of one-note character you'd expect during Tenma's fall.
She seems like window dressing for Tenma's backstory.
Exactly. You know, after she breaks up with him to go on with whatever next popular guy's at the hospital, you'd expect her to stop being involved. But she shows up again. She has this like little short story with her gardener that's very touching, and then her dramatic downfall. But she also has, towards the end, one of my favorite quotes from this series, and I'm totally paraphrasing this here because I don't have it verbatim, but she's basically talking about, she's in a conversation with the Wilford Brimley fucking psychologist. I don't know how to pronounce his actual name. Like,
Dr. Reichwein.
Reichwein. She's having this conversation with him about happiness.
Reichwein, I guess.
And she's talking about a character she's known that's died, and she's like, yes, you know, happiness, all the sad memories I have of him are slowly fading away, leaving all the happiness, only the happy ones behind. Humans are really convenient that way, aren't they? And, the doctor's like, no, you know, that's how it's supposed to be. But she gets enough of a kind of closure to a story that it's happy, but you're still like, it's been a rough ride for a couple of these people here. And yeah, it's interesting to see the paths they follow towards the end.
At the end of everything, I feel like there's only one character who really gets a happy ending. And it's the one character that probably most needs it. Everyone else kind of has little bittersweet endings, where it's like, well, they survived and that's what's important. But we'll get into that some more later. And it's, what's interesting is the fact that as much as I expected, you know, Johan to murder everyone, basically, while eventually some very important characters do die after being around for a considerable period of time, a lot of them survive way longer than I expected them to. And that actually really helps to ground the series, because you follow despite the fact that a lot of characters get built up, feel very important, and then get off, there are some that last until the end game. And so then you're just kind of like, oh, well, now I've followed these characters for such a long period of time, and so I'm still really invested in this climax, as opposed to, say, if these characters would have had to be introduced 30 chapters earlier because every other important character has been killed by Johan.
Yeah. It's a somber story and dark in a lot of ways, but it is a story that is ultimately underlined very much by hope. Because that's the big motivating thing that Tenma uses to encourage people. Well, there's a young boy we haven't even talked about, Dieter,
who I could not believe that he stuck around for as long as he did.
He's essentially like the emotional core for Tenma to kind of keep him earnest. Like, you need to be around because, Tenma won't kill Johan so long as you're around, because he won't let you lose your innocence too. So he's kind of this, and he wants to stay along because he has a devotion to Tenma after Tenma saves him. And I think the quote Tenma gives him is like, tomorrow will be better.
Right.
And that
it's an opposite to what Johan tells people, where it's like, there's nothing good in the world, basically. So you might as well become a murdering psychopath like me, or you might as well kill yourself, or whatever. And on the other hand, Tenma just tells Dieter, it's like, tomorrow will be bright. I know that you've been through a lot, but the world is good, and you have so much to look forward to. So don't give up your hope.
And it gets to this scene where Dieter runs into a boy who is at the top of a hospital. Apparently, what Johan did, because Johan is this freak weirdo who is essentially like this perfect Hitler of charisma, who could just walk around and everyone adores him, and children look up to him, and he seems so nice. But what he does is he convinces the children in this town to play a game where they will close their eyes and walk along the rooftop of a hospital towards each other, and when they open their eyes...
The edge of a roof. Walk along the guardrail, basically.
Yeah, and when they open their eyes, I've survived, and the other boy didn't. And you know what
don't say that. They say, the other boy wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. But their reward for winning the game is to just get to play it again some other time. Like, it's just...
And then if you survive the game, you get to play again, too.
Yeah, like, it's just this notion that you just get to keep playing. Like, it's just this horrible thing that Johan created for no other reason than to just see children
kill
himself.
He has no goal for this.
No, there's no advantage to it. It doesn't play into his long-term plans at all. He just went somewhere and wanted to create misery. And Dieter sees these kids doing it, and the kids, like, challenge him, like, I want you to play this game with me. And Dieter sits there, and he's like, I had a great sandwich the other day, and if I die now, I'll never get to have that again. I love playing soccer, and if I die now, I'll never get to have it again. This boy's just like, stop being such a sissy. You're just a big wuss. And, eventually Dieter just gets through there. I'm like, aren't you afraid right now that you won't be able to do any of the things you like anymore? He finally then, re-utters the phrase, tomorrow will be a better day. And he convinces this kid to stop playing this suicidal, horrifying game. It's like, there's these big, tense moments like that, and you're like, God, Johan is such a horrifying person at times. Like, this is what he does just for shits and giggles as he's walking around the world. He's like, oh, I'm in this town, I'm going to destroy the youth while I'm here.
That was the weird thing about it, is because almost every other thing that Johan did, it seemed to be for a reason. He did stuff, and I guess it just comes down to the fact that basically, Johan has developed this, not even really a cult following, basically the organization that quote-unquote created him, or they think that they created him, they think that they are working together with him, and that he was working according to this plan that they have to basically, create the Fourth Reich or some shit. I don't actually know what their ultimate goal was. It was to have Johan.
Be racist, I know that.
It was to have Johan and have him lead them or something like that. Basically, through a lot of the series, they think that he is acting according to this plan that they have. But instead, Johan's just kind of doing it so long as it amuses him and so long as it furthers his own goals. It is, his primary goal is, to have someone like Nina or Tenma kill him. But other than that, it just seems to be, I felt like killing him. And they say at some certain points, like, oh, he killed all the foster families that he had as a kid just because he got tired of them, basically. So it seems as though he does have the major goal of basically becoming, I can't, basically becoming a monster.
His goal is to be the last one standing. His goal is essentially to just convince humanity to kill themselves, to bring out, that allegory that he does with the Kinderheim, where he's just going to be the oil that he splashes on people, the catalyst that brings out the monster in people, and they'll kill each other, and at the end of it all, he'll be the only one left standing.
But despite that, he did seem to be working towards a goal without just aimlessly killing people through the grand majority of the series, except until he's just like, I just think I'll just kill these kids, you know.
Yeah, he's like, fuck these children. I think there was a point, too, he had some sort of message to give them, like, oh, you'll only become strong if we're able to face your fears like this. But it was very much like, here are some people I can manipulate, and he feels nothing from it, seemingly. He doesn't seem to express any emotion at all. Like, that's the thing, whenever someone sees one of his crime scenes, the only thing they could really notice, they're like, it's completely devoid of emotion. There's nothing in it. There's no rage. There's no lust. There's no anger. There's nothing. There's just death here, and it's disturbing. And it's an interesting kind of character that gets created from this, because you see Johan, again, very sparingly. We don't get to see him in the act all that often, so when you do see it, it makes him very unnerving, because he almost has this sort of supernatural kind of mystique to him, where anytime someone sees him, again, if it's 10 months, the only thing he'll do, he'll just point to his forehead, like, come on, go ahead. But then when you get a story like Richard Brom, this private eye who he's, you know, trying to recover from alcoholism and, you know, trying to get away from this horrible mistake he's made, and Johan just basically manipulates him into eventually falling back into a horrible depression. And, like, it's just these heartbreaking stories that he gets involved with, all leading up to this, the big climax at the end, where he wants to create this quote-unquote perfect suicide. It's a very disturbing and horrifying character in that regard, and that's what makes him such an effective villain in that way.
I guess I think we've just about discussed this as much as we can without actually talking into the real heavy spoiler territory, so I guess we want to go into that for a few minutes.
Yeah, so, everybody, if you have not read Monster yet, and you want to,
You definitely should.
Yeah, I would highly recommend you go check it out now, because we are going to have to delve into spoilers. So, be forewarned, if you haven't read it, stop now.
Come back in a few minutes if you're watching it live, and I guess we'll put a little timestamp at the bottom or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Something.
So, basically, what we find out is that Johan and Nina basically were actually created by this one program that was behind Kinderheim 511, and that they think that that Johan is working together with them. Because they actually did, like, eugenics type of stuff. They had, you know, these perfect people in terms of social status and, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, and so on and so forth. Had a whole ton of them pair off and have babies. And Nina and Johan were born of this one woman. She managed to escape with them at one point. And then stuff happened, basically, at this one, was it the Red Rose Mansion, I think?
Red Ray, I think that's what it is.
And basically, what happened was nearly or more than 50 people were killed. And for the grand majority of the series, or at the very least, when you first learned about this, of course you think, oh, Johan did it. Turns out Nina did it. Mm-hmm. And she, after she got away, she basically had been made to forget about it because the guy who had orchestrated the whole thing basically hypnotized her into forgetting it. But before she forgot everything, she told Johan all about it, and he convinced himself that he had done it instead. And this furthered his descent into becoming the Antichrist, basically. While Nita thought that nothing had happened with her. And so this, of course, furthers the whole thing where Nia thinks, oh, what if I'm, you know, a monster too? Or what if there's a monster inside of me, and so on and so forth. Has a huge crisis of conscience because of it. And, yeah. That's one of the major twists in the series.
It was, at the first time I read through it, I understood none of it. I remember being like, this is so confusing. What's happening? I didn't actually, this is one of the few parts of the series I didn't get to reread, but I read a lot of, like, ancillary stuff to be like, oh, okay, now I'm grasping exactly what happens. It's interesting because, essentially, this is what creates Johan the monster. And it's weird because he does it out of, like, a consideration for his sister, like, empathy for his sister, and that's what...
But he was already dressing up like her. He was already weird.
Well, that was placed upon by the mother, too, because that's a large part of it. Basically, they force... Yeah, because what happened is the mom... They're going to take a kid. They force her to take a kid, so what she did in preparation was she dressed both of them up like Nina, so that that way she could seemingly protect Johan, and... That's, like, the thing. At the one, when they take to one of the kids, the mom's like, no, no, don't take this one. Wait, hold on, no, take this one. And she pushes one of the kids forward, and that's the,
like,
thought.
That's, like, the last thing you learn the whole series.
Basically. Yeah, that's what Johan has been dealing with the entire time. He's like, did mother actually mean to save me, or did she make the mistake and give the wrong kid? Because you don't know which kid she meant to protect. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting in that regard. Like, what kid was she trying to protect? You know, how much of that was really the crux of all this? It's interesting in that regard, I feel.
And then, of course, he took that burden off of Nina and took it onto himself. But of course, the question then has to be asked: is it because he loved his sister, or is it because he wanted to basically go down that path himself? Mm-hmm. And it's another question that doesn't really go answered, but you know, it's fine.
You'll get a lot of questions like that.
But at the end of things, it's like most of the questions the series have been answered, only for there to be a few more, because like, oh, you thought you kind of had everything figured out. Well, not quite. Psychopaths, it turns out, are not that easy to understand if they're so evil you could be compared to the Antichrist.
No, go ahead.
This organization that orchestrated this, another thing that happens is that the guy behind it was also this children's storybook author. And he did these stories, and a lot of allegories are kind of tied to these stories that he wrote. The most prominent among them being The Monster with No Name.
Which is a great little short story, too.
It's such a cool little story, although it's dark as fuck, and you should not give it to children.
yeah, I was like, what the fuck's up with Germany? And you were like, oh, what a great story. Let's give it to all of our kids.
So, basically, this guy wrote this book in which a demon, or a monster, rather, wants a name. So, first off, he splits into two, and one goes west and one goes east. And so, the one that goes east, I believe, basically possesses all these different people, but eventually he devours them from the inside after giving them strength, until he eventually finds this one prince named Johan, and he doesn't actually devour the kid from the inside. Instead, he eats everyone else in the kingdom. And then he goes back west, and he finds the monster, and the monster's like, oh, well, I want the name now, so I'm going to eat you. And the kid just eats him instead. It's like, well, okay.
And then it's like the tragic thing at the end, he's like, oh, what a shame. Now there was no one left to call him by his name. What a shame. Johan was such a nice name, too. You're like, oh, that's fucked up.
So, of course, you get the impression, oh, well, Johan's been influenced by this from a very early age. And one of the things that is impressed upon you is Johan's not his real, quote-unquote, name. It was just given to him at a certain point. And he has changed names multiple times. Every time he was adopted as a kid, he changed names, but he still goes by Johan for the most part. And one of the things that kind of confused me was, well, why is that really important, you know, what his name actually is? And eventually, finally, you get an answer, which is, if you don't have a name, if people don't know who you are, then you can basically be anything or anyone. So he is trying to completely erase his past and erase everyone who knows anything about him so that he can basically become inhuman.
And not Marvel Inhumans with the lame powers that aren't X-Men, but kind of are. He means inhuman like I'm transcendently evil.
Right. So he decides the best way to do this is to just force an entire town full of people to kill each other.
That's the climax. I forget the name of the town, like Rendon.
Rosenheim, I think.
Rosenheim. And that's the big climax of the series, where basically every major character who's left shows up. I think the only ones who don't are Dieter and
Rubenheim.
I think it's just Dieter and the doctor, the Wilford Bimley doctor, like basically the only two major characters at that point who don't show up in that town. And it's a very climactic town because a lot of things go down there. Again, spoilers if you haven't read the series yet, but that's where quite a few of our characters up until that point actually die. It's where Grimmer, unfortunately, has his last moments too in this great scene, because we didn't even really get into Grimmer either. The major thing about Grimmer is that he tells the story about how he watched a cartoon as a child, or I guess maybe it was a live action, but it was a kid's show.
The about Magnificent this, Steiner!
Yeah,
which probably starred Scott Steiner, let's face it.
Scott Steiner is an Incredible Hulk XP. It's essentially the story of this character. He's like a weak, timid guy who gets into trouble, but you know, whenever things are at their worst, a great hero shows up to save him, the Magnificent Steiner. But what the guy never realizes is that he's the Magnificent Steiner all along. And Grimmer has this same thing, that whenever bad things happen to him, he kind of loses himself. And when he wakes up, the Steiner has saved him, only it's with horrific brutality and usually has killed a lot of people around him. And, you know, it's left him with this pang of guilt whenever he has it. And he's also suffered this loss. He had a son at one point. And he's just been unable to express emotion, and even when his son died, he seemed to not be able to really express himself quite well with it.
Basically, being in Kinderheim 511 removed all of his emotions, mm-hmm. and so his wife left him because he didn't seem to actually be sad when their son died, because he couldn't feel sadness.
He couldn't get it out anymore. So we get to this climax in the town, and it's essentially Johan putting his axe into play again, where he's going to convince this town to start killing each other. And it's happening. People are going about killing each other. Neighbors are killing their own neighbors just because there's so much panic and paranoia and hysteria going on. And in this moment, Grimmer's trying to basically help defend the town, and he sees across the street there are a bunch of guys with automatic weapons. And all this town has, because it's a small, closed-off town, they have nothing but really handguns. He goes out to try to stop them, sees another character get gunned down right in front of him, loses it, becomes the initial, becomes the Magnificent Steiner again, and when we see him again, he's taken out everyone in the building, but he's been mortally wounded. And in this moment, he starts thinking back to what must have the final episode of the Magnificent Steiner actually been like, because he never got to see it. And he's like, I bet in the end, he learned he was human too, and he starts to actually cry, and he starts to have real emotions again and recognize, like, I was sad when my son died. I can feel again. And it's just this horrifically sad scene where you're just like, oh, God, no, why's Steiner? Grandma, no!
Well, first of all, the woman that he sees get gunned down, she recognized him and as basically her hero. There was just this little small detail where it was like she was waiting for the right man to come and take her away from everything. And when she saw him when they were in danger, she, like, waved to him because she realized he was going to save her and take her away from everything. They had a little bit of a kind of thing going on. And when she gets gunned down in front of him, he, like, holds her in his arms, like, bridal style after she's died. He freaks out and, he cut away. He comes back and he's, dying. He has that breakdown, of course. And before he had set off in the first place, he kind of, because he and Lunge met for the first time when they came to town independently. And so they're kind of working together. They've got a few people holed up inside this hotel, trying to protect them. And Grimmer realizes he's got to go out to the building across the street, and he's got to try and neutralize the gunners who are holding them down. And he says to Lunge, Lunge says to him, when this is over, let's share a beer together. And Grimmer says, yeah, good one. And of course, after he's died in the final chapter, Lunge comes to his grave with a few other people, and he takes a beer out and he puts it down in his grave.
Oh, it's so tragic.
That one scene, more than anything else in the series, broke my heart. And there's so much sad stuff, but it was that one that got to me the most. It was just that one little thing. It's like, oh, I wish we could have had a beer together.
Because it's important for a lot of reasons. I mean, one, it's this closure for Grimmer, a character who never even knew his name. His real name was not Wolfgang Grimmer. Like everyone in Kinderheim 511, most of them don't know their names. You even get this small detail that Roberto, a character we haven't even discussed to this point, essentially the main lieutenant enforcer for Johann,
and he's got all sorts of fucked up stuff going on with him too.
Yeah, him and Grimmer were friends when they were in Kinderheim 511. Roberto, this horrible, remorseless murderer, actually was a guy who was like, "No, let the butterflies glow. I love bugs, but you can't keep the butterflies in cage." When he was a kid, as adults now, from everything that's happened, they don't even recognize each other when they meet, and. What happens is that in addition to Grimmer, you know, dying there, that scene also has a lot of impact because Lunge actually through these events has actually started to develop emotion again. And in those moments, he expresses himself, you know, in this fight with Roberto, he has anger. He has, like a snap at him finally when Roberto just starts taunting him about the fact that his wife has been cheating on him and that, his daughter has had his grandson, and that she's...
Your granddaughter is calling your wife's new husband her grandpa.
Yeah, like, it's just taunting with him. He finally is just like, shut up! And starts, you know, going at him. But it ends with him at the grave, too, and he drops off, and he's like, yeah, I've been able to get back in touch with my daughter again. It's through email, but we're making progress. It's just like, oh, like... To see where those characters have gone through this slow but strong development, it broke my heart again, Nick, to read the scene with Grimmer again. I'd forgotten just how tough it is to see him go down, because he's such a great character. But it was just such an emotionally satisfying conclusion all the way through.
And what eventually happens is after Nina has gone through everything, the realization, basically, she reaches a point where she could have killed Johann. And then she has that realization that she was the one who had killed the people in the mansion. And so when Temma comes across her, because, of course, he was tracking down Johann at the same time, she's pointing the gun at her own head, and she wants to kill herself. Temma stops her. She goes back and forth across Europe something like 4 times after that. She goes back and forth a lot. Temma kind of, like, constantly was going in one direction. And apparently she was taking the plane or something.
it's like Littlefinger in the Game of Thrones TV series where he just hops in his Prius and travels about. You're like, weren't you in the Vale? How'd you get to Winterfell? Oh, you're in King's Landing now. That's strange. Seems it takes years in the books, but you really hop about.
And so they finally both arrive in Rudenheim as well. And they finally... track down Johann, and Johann confronts them, and he's like, yeah, we're finally all here, you know. And I think he finds Tenma first, and I think Nina comes later. It's one or the other. And also, the guy who was behind the whole operation is there as well.
Sigmund Freud.
Basically. I forget what his actual name is, but he has about five different...
Franz Bonaparte, I think is his actual name.
Right, and he's got about 5 different pen names, because he's the guy who wrote the storybooks as well. Mm-hmm. But Franz basically is like, I have to destroy what I created. But it's like, you were only introduced 10 chapters ago. Good luck, asshole. So, he and Temma encounter Johann first. Temma's like, I'm going to stop him. And Franz hits him on the back of the head. He's like, no, I'm going to handle this. And so he pulls his gun on Johann. But Roberto arrives in the scene, shoots him through, like, the neck.
Oh, it is... For a character who was starting to kind of get a little bit of a face, like, to the point where you're like, I don't like you, but I don't think you're as evil as Johann.
He was trying to redeem himself, and wasn't just doing it that moment. He had tried to redeem himself through the course of his entire life after the experiments had failed, basically.
And he just gets... a death that is in no way, shape, or form, like, gives no sympathy to him. Like, it's just shot brutally through the neck. Just no mercy in it.
So, Roberto shows up, and he's been shot by Lunge already. He's got this blood pouring out everywhere. He shows up in front of Johan, and he's like, "Oh, why can't I see what you saw?" And Johan just looks at him down, does not care for him in the slightest, and he's just like, "Because you can't."
It's so... Like, Johan is the biggest asshole on the planet. The only dude on the fucking planet who seemed to be truly, like, not insane. I guess he was insane in his own way. But, like, the most loyal person to him on the planet in his final moments is like, "A little bit? Can you give me just a little?" And Johan's like, "Nah.
Nope.
Hey, can you die now? I'm kind of in my thing."
Yeah. So it looks like Tenma is going to shoot him. It looks like Nina's going to shoot him. It looks like Tenma's going to shoot him. Blah, blah, blah. And he's holding a kid at gunpoint.
That's the thing, is he...
He's forcing him to do it. He's like, "I'm going to shoot this little boy in front of you right now unless you kill me by shooting me in the head."
Because Nina has a pretty important point there where she sees the room has those numbers, and she notes, she's like, "I forgive you." And she notes,
"That's right, I forgot
if I forgived him back then when she first walked in on him after he murdered their parents, maybe none of this would have happened."
Yeah, I could have led him down the path to redemption instead. That's why I forgot. She's actually reached that conclusion by the time shows up in town. Of course, Tenma hasn't gone through what she's gone through. He still has that guilt he's dealing with all the different people that Johan has killed along the way because Tenma saved his life. And so Tenma is ready to shoot him, and the boy's drunk-ass father, who has never met Johan, Johan has nothing to do with him, he sees his little kid in trouble, and he shoots Johan in the head. Someone who has nothing to do with Johan at all. He was just one of the guys in the town. He was forcing to kill each other. He just shoots him, and that's basically it. Johan doesn't die, though.
No, that's the thing, because I know some people might look at this and be like, what a shitty end to that story, because it doesn't answer the question. It actually does answer the question, because the crux of everything about Monster and the points trying to make comes in right afterwards, where they look and they're like, this guy still has a pulse. And Lunge is being put into the helicopter as well, and he's like, "I know the brain surgeon." And they go to Johan,
right over there,
who's being comforted with Nina, and the situation is presented right to them. You can save Johan again. And the choice that Tenma makes is to go in and perform the same surgery on him again, and essentially do it all over again. He makes the same decision, even knowing the kind of stuff that happened the last time he saved this kid. He's going to do it because Tenma still believes that all lives are created equal, and that nobody should be killed just for their crimes. Now, you can sit there and say, "Well, I don't agree with that," and that's perfectly fine. That's the point that was ultimately made as well, because Wim's father, he didn't give a fuck. He doesn't care about all lives being equal. He's like, "You're trying to kill my kid!" Glug, glug, glug. But it's great, because that's the point it tries to make in this climax between Johan and Tenma. Tenma ultimately doesn't kill him, and when the situation comes that he could wash his hands of the situation and walk away, no, he chooses to be the good guy again.
Right.
And recreate the situation.
I can totally understand if you're just like, "Oh, was Tenma actually going to shoot him?" They never answer that. Well, it doesn't matter. Tenma chose to save his life. And if anything, he could have walked away with even less guilt for letting Johan die than he could have for actually killing him. Mm-hmm. But instead, he just goes in and he saves his life. And so, yeah, the ultimate question of would Johan ultimately end up finishing off, you know, bringing Tenma to corruption and make him a monster as well? No. He stuck to being a good doctor, and so there you go. And he saved his life. Johan gets to live.
Yeah, Johan not only gets to live, he gets to presumably... well, that's the thing.
We don't know what happens after that.
You don't know what happens ultimately at the end with Johan. The last chapter is essentially a little bit of a tease, like, oh, maybe Johan... Or not Johan, maybe Tenma and... what's her name? Nina. Maybe Nina has feelings for Johan. That's something else that doesn't really get answered. They kind of show a little bit...
I didn't get that impression at all.
I see a little bit of admiration.
He's like 15 years younger than him.
There's a little bit of something there.
No!
Maybe I'm just getting into shipping too much.
That's
anyway, the last chapter, though, is ultimately... She hugs him a lot, is all I'm saying. The last chapter is a lot of Johan... Or not Johan, sorry. Tenma finally meets
their mother.
And finds out their names. And he goes
we don't know what their names are.
Yeah, doesn't tell us. That's fine. It's the Sopranos sayings. Their names can be whatever you want them to be, except unlike the fucking Sopranos.
I hope. I'm going to say that their names were Hana and Shmiggy.
Okay, Hana and Chimmy. Okay.
Shmiggy.
Shmiggy. Oh, Shmiggy. That's. Oh man, I really hope Shmiggy was Nina. Like, really, a real fuck.
This little girl will be Hana Holtenheim, and this will be Shmiggy. He doesn't get a last name.
And he like asked the fucking Tenma at the end, like, which one do you think my mom loved more? And he's like, I don't.
So you were Shmiggy, so.
You were Shmiggy, no name, so. I'm going to say she didn't care for you.
Unless she thought that was the best name ever.
He's like, I'm going to guess that she probably meant to keep the other one.
Well, I'm going to leave the hospital bed and go be a serial killer now. Thanks for saving my life twice, Doc.
But that's the thing. He goes in and tells him, like, you did have a name. And he tries to kind of give him, like, this hope. Like, you weren't...
You were loved. You had a name, basically.
Yeah, you had a name. You were loved. And in this weird moment, Johan just sits straight fucking up.
He doesn't sit up. When Tenma looks at him, he is sitting up.
Yeah, like, it's just this moment where he's like, I'm awake, sitting up, staring at you with these intense eyes that just fill you, Tenma, with dread again, and he asks him that question. In that moment, when my mom was asked to give up one of the children, do you think she meant to protect me, or did she make a mistake and give the wrong child? And Tenma doesn't really have an answer, and then when he kind of...
He doesn't know. It's the first he's heard about.
Yeah, and when he snaps to, Johan's, you know, back peacefully in bed, presumably still in a coma, you don't really know. And Johan, or Tenma, just kind of steps away, walks out of the door, we see him in the window, and then the next shot you see, Johan's bed's empty, and I believe there's actually a, like, I don't know if it's a, basically there's like a follow-up series that's called Another Monster, and the only thing you really get out of it, it's kind of mostly just superfluous materials, but
right.
The one thing they do confirm is that 3 years later, Johan is still alive out in the world. We don't know if he's become a killer again. We don't know what he's doing. You can kind of ask that question to yourself, but we do know Johan still lives at the end of it. So it's a very interesting story in that way, and I feel it's great for provoking a lot of questions and discussion that I wish we had more time to even do.
Well, yeah,
this.
It's like, did Tenma... Did that actually happen, or did Tenma hallucinate it, or whatever, you know?
Does Tenma make the right decision? Can you agree with
it?
You know, what should have happened in this situation? Should someone, because Tenma cannot be the one to kill this guy, should someone else come in and just be like, sorry, Tenma, boom, 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 like, I gotta put a stop to this. Or does he deserve a chance to, you know, he finds out he has a true name, does he deserve a chance to see if he can change, you know? It's
right.
There's a lot of characters also in this series, you know, it's The ex-soldier we talked about, one of the guys who kills Nina's parents, finds out that he, you know, finds a family and he gets redemption and he, you know, can change too. It's, you know, with a question of, you know, what does Johan deserve ultimately? It's something that provokes a lot of questions. I feel it's what makes this series so interesting, what makes it such a strong piece. I truly believe that Urasawa is a genius when it comes to writing these stories, because he's it's stuff that I feel like in the hands of so many other people would just come off hokey or annoying, but he has such an effective way of delivering it all that I'm like, no, this is interesting, it's emotionally gripping, and in many ways it's very thought-provoking as well. Like, it's not without faults, but it's one of those series where I sit back and I'm like, this is something I could keep, I'm going to hold on to, and I honestly wish I could give to more people, because I feel like even if you don't like people who never read manga, I'd be like, I feel like if I give you this, you could absolutely enjoy it just the same way.
Oh, because
you know?
it's so, yeah. I mean, you talked about the potential,
like,
of it being an HBO series. That would work so effectively, I think. You know, because there are times when it just feels like, oh, this would just fit into a nice little episode. And then you can move on, and they would all be connected and so on and so forth, but you could also have these individual little stories that would all fit together as well. And it feels different from a lot of manga because it's so serious, really. I thought that it was a very good series. And yeah, I'm going to also say it's not perfect. I'm not sure what I would do to improve it, other than maybe cut out a few of the little stories, maybe not focus so much time on these individual little things. But none of those individual stories were bad, I don't think. there was never a point when I was reading the series and I felt like I was bored. It's a tremendous page turner.
Yes.
Such incredibly gripping characters. It flows amazingly well. At the end of everything, it's just like, okay, well, you know, these guys are finally getting back to, you know, real life, sort of. There is hope for the future because, you know, basically, in the end, it turns out that the whole story was about the struggle between the potential for evil inside of everyone going up against the potential for good inside of everyone. And even though it said, oh, well, Johan has survived, and so maybe he'll keep on spreading evil, there still feels like a tremendous note of finality, good won out in the end today. You know, Tenma made a decision for good. He chose life over death. And also, Nina got to have a happy ending. She got through everything. She was kind of assuaged of a lot of her guilt. And she's going to go and become a lawyer someday. And she's going to take all of that awesome eugenics that she and Johan have, and she's actually going to do some good in the world because, well, she's got a lot of ground to make up for because Johan's dug them a big asshole, hasn't he? Oh, fuck that guy. He's such an asshole.
It's going to be so hard, Nick, with all of her unresolved feelings for Tenma.
What feelings are you getting at?
I feel like fucking Kitoro Osamu has opened me up into shipping everything now. Didn't you feel like Noelle and Fuego Leon had a little something-something before you got killed?
I'd buy that sooner than I would Tenma and Nina. Her pseudo-father figure. Don't be pulling that on me, Chris. You know better than the rest of our listeners.
I'm like, Nick, don't you feel like fucking Kana and Kenji for 20th Century Boys had a little something-something? Like, Nick or Chris, they were actually fucking father and daughter, basically. Uncle and niece at the very worst.
Oh, God. Okay, fine, Nick. I guess we'll just ship Johan and Nina. No!
Interestingly enough, that does not feel like it comes up at all, though.
Well, no, because Johan
is asexual.
He thinks of himself as Nina, partially, too. Yeah. By the way, we didn't even touch on that. Johan spends approximately 1/8 of this series in drag posing as Nina.
That is great.
I knew that he had done that before, by the way. I'd heard about him cross-dressing. So when finally came time for Anna to show up in the series, is like, yeah, that's actually Johan.
It was so disturbing when it happens.
Because Nina didn't call herself Anna, so nice little hint laid in there so that you would know, or at least suspect something was up.
It's also interesting, too.
That poor fucking agent.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's really just the fuck with that one. I mean, you get stuff out of it, but it's just like this poor fucking guy who's
I would seduce this guy normally, but I think he's not gay, so I'll put on a wig.
Yeah, and he's just like, I met this pretty girl at a bar, and this is a love story that's gonna go places. And you're like, oh, I'm so sorry, Agent Juke, or whatever your name was.
Suka.
Agent Suk. I have a lot of respect, a lot of admiration for this series. I think if I were to compare it to 20th Century Boys, I think I'd enjoy 20th Century Boys a little bit more, if only because that's an epic that I feel like I can get invested in a little bit more, because it has like the music ties to it and like the supernatural elements all over the place, and it's a big giant thing. With this, is, you know, it's not small by any means, it's smaller in comparison, but I rereading it this time made me appreciate it so much more than I think I did the first time. There's a lot of stuff to pick up on, so many characters who are just developed in splendid ways, a lot of very sweet kind of short stories that hit you in sad and in good places at times. There's a lot of sad moments where a lot of characters you like do suffer horrible endings, and it's usually done in ways where you're like, oh god, this guy's like, I'm definitely gonna call my daughter tomorrow and fix everything. You're like, oh god, this dude's gonna get fucking murdered tonight.
Well, the thing is that there are a lot of characters that were like that. There is one character who is I forget who he is. He's just this basically mostly unimportant prosecutor, but he shows up at the beginning of the series as the investigator in the case, and then years later he shows up as prosecutor on the verge of retirement, and they keep on talking about it. I was like, oh, he's just about to retire. he doesn't die. He just retires.
You're like, whoa, holy shit.
So it was, he keeps you on your toes in that respect. Not every character that seems like, oh, well, Johan's obviously going to kill this guy. They don't always die. So then the ones that do, it hits harder because they could have made it, damn it.
But it's such a great, most of the stories are very good. And I just think overall, I really, really enjoy this series. I don't know if it's necessarily the perfect Halloween pick.
No.
But it's, I think, one pick you definitely should read. I stand by my statement of saying, if you were to make a comparison, Naraki Urasawa was basically kind of like the Alan Moore of manga. It's someone who you can give his work to somebody who is not interested in the medium whatsoever, and generally speaking, they're probably going to really enjoy it because it's a very smart writer behind it.
Although, from what I understand, Naoki Urasawa does not hate the comic book industry.
So. No, no, I don't think he sits around walking around like the manga and just, fuck this thing, I hate all of this.
All this bullshit. I would say that I liked this more than 20th Century Boys. I feel like it's a more consistent series. I feel
The ending's a thousand times better.
Way more satisfying ending and way more satisfying revelations in terms of the mystery surrounding it. Johan is not just some guy that they didn't remember from class.
Some dude who you discovered through a virtual reality system.
Oh, God, so weird. I would not say that it is... I'm not going to say, oh, 10 out of 10. But a 9 out of 10. Mm-hmm. And if I gave... Because, first of all, I don't give scores out of 10. But if I gave scores out of 10, I would not give decimals out of 10. But it would be a high 9 out of 10.
But I'm saying like a 9.78.
I say that, but it's like, it is the highest I can possibly recommend it without saying, this is the best thing ever, basically. And also without saying shit like, you know, well, I should 21 is a 10 out of 10 for me, because fuck you, that's why I like that series too much. I really, really think it's very good, both objectively and subjectively. I think that I would recommend this to basically anyone who would enjoy a kind of mystery thriller with some dark tones and stuff. Very well done series.
All right. Well, I believe we are about...
We're a little bit more than an hour in.
A little more than an hour in, so I guess it's time to actually talk about the other series.
I don't think that this was as long as we went on about 20th Century Boys, so there we go.
a small condolence.
Yeah. Right? Let's hit up the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap and see if we can't make it out of here before we reach 3 hours. Let's go. Black Clover, page...
Don't you mean Black... No.
Adversity. So, Pagolian...
Wait, no, Nick, I had another one. Don't you mean... Pumpkin Spice Black Clover?
What the fuck does that mean?
I feel like white girls would really enjoy this series, so the way to get them into it is to put pumpkin spice in it.
Okay. So Fagolian is apparently dead. He's bleeding everywhere. His arm's been blown off after he's been dumped in by Spatial Magic Dude. Lion. That is his name. Or is it Leon or Lion? I forget.
Fago Leon, and then his brother is...
I think it's Lion with a Y, isn't it?
I feel like it's some cat. I can't remember anymore.
He and Noel, like, rush towards Fagoli, and meanwhile, Ast is like, oh, my wounds are everywhere, blah. Lion has this actually very neat little sequence of rapid-fire flashbacks where he just, you know, remembers their time growing up together as brothers, and Fagolian guiding him along the way as he got into the Magic Knights and stuff, and he's like, oh, Fagolian, no, it can't be, and so on and so forth. And he's like, this, you know, my brother can't lose. But Noel observes that Fagolian's grimoire is still intact. So he's like, okay, if he's still here, then, you know, that means he's still alive, and so maybe we can save him. But Mimosa's not here, and she realizes that the grimoire is also starting to grumble. Leopold, that's his name. So she says to Leopold, come on, you know, you gotta help me save him, and so on and so forth. At that moment, Cursed Magic Dude...
I feel like we know his... Ruddies.
Ruddies, yeah. He's like, oh, he taunted me, and blah, blah, blah. I remember when you were mouthing off to me, and... Leo just kind of blasts him with... He gets blasted with fire.
Yes.
How does this guy have fire magic all of a sudden? He only knows one spell. Whatever. So, he gets blasted away somehow. And Noel continues desperately trying to save Fagolian and so on and so forth. And Ray's like, ah, you talked to me about having a just heart. Well, I do just what my heart tells me to. I spent the last 5 minutes thinking of that
comment. That's a pretty good line, though. I do like it.
Spatial Magic Guy is like, come on, Radius, let's get out of here. And he starts to summon a portal beneath Radius so that they can escape. And Ash is like, no, I'm not going to let you get away. And Radius is like, well, I'm going to kill you later on, so look forward to that. And Ash is like, oh, he's too far away. I can't make it. Wait a minute. I know! And he throws his sword in order to disrupt the spatial magic. Okay, Asta does some things in this chapter that are stupid, but I thought this was pretty awesome, honestly. Just fucking throwing this giant cleaver through the air to use his anti-magic to stop him from getting away. I thought that was pretty cool.
It is clever.
So Asta engages the guy in close combat, and of course, spatial magic guy keeps on trying to teleport Radius to safety, but Asta's just like, nope, I'm still here. I'm going to just disperse it immediately by stabbing it with my sword because it's broken. And Ray's like, oh, stop it. Stop hitting me. It hurts.
Why has he gained a lisp? Like, oh my God, stop it.
It hurts.
Ouchies.
Oh my God. I'm like Alice now.
Oh my God. I'm Alice.
So he's like, oh, people with weak magic should let people with strong magic keep them around, because that's how everyone in this series thinks, and you have no magic, so I look down on you and ask to headbutt him. Second awesome moment. It's like, shut up, and he headbutts him. I think Asta kind of balances out, because he does two stupid broken things and two pretty awesome things in this fight sequence. And so he's like, ah, it doesn't matter, blah, blah, blah. Spatial Magic Guy is like, I'll have to take out that boy first. And he summons a portal behind Asta so that he can attack him from behind. And Noah's like, oh no, he's going to attack him through that. Asta, look out. But Leo is back on his feet, and he blasts the guy with the column of fire to distract him from attacking Asta. And so he's like, oh, I just got to do what Fagolian told me to, and stay calm so that I can act accordingly and stuff. So remembering his brother's lesson, even in a desperate situation. And Ray's like, all right, fine then. I'll take you out or some shit. You know, the tables have just turned and a bunch of guys in cloaks so you can't see their faces and thus you don't think they're important. / they can reveal themselves to be important by unmasking later, but probably not because they all look completely identical in those robes. I bet they're probably going to just not be important.
Anyway. I bet the far left guy looks kind of fatter than the other ones. I bet he's a big deal.
Also, they have piercing cold magic, so it makes me think that they're related to that group of guys that the Black Bulls fought earlier. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, so Ray's like, ah, oh, the tables have turned. So Asta is like, all right, well, I'm bleeding everywhere still because of your stupid curse magic, so... And he cuts himself across his wounds with his swords. And they're like, oh, he just used his swords to nullify the curse magic in his wounds that was forcing him to bleed.
God damn it, Asta.
Asta's so fucking broken. Like, you can't put any status effects on this guy. He just has a constant cure-all option on him. He doesn't even have to burn mana on it.
Remember when Zoro did this against Kabaji way back in the day? It was like this cool moment where he's like, I don't have enough of a handicap, so I'm going to cut myself even deeper. It's like, ah, it's kind of like that, except this one's...
Except Asta didn't actually draw blood, and he actually stopped the bleeding by doing this.
He's like, oh, I actually healed myself through it. Like, God damn it.
My swords have healing properties, too.
I'm waiting for the time when somebody starts fucking with him, like, Mimosa's like, here's a healing spell, Asta, and someone fucking throws his stupid-ass sword through it. It's like, no, you don't get healing! He's like, no!
That was for you! Oh, God. So, an up and down chapter, because that's basically where it ends. Asta's just like, I'll keep on... I've dealt with adversity all the time, it doesn't matter, and blah, blah, blah. I guess that it's a bit more intense because they're trying desperately to save Fagolian's life. And Asta is now dealing with greater odds all on his own when Fagolian was basically handling stuff before. But... Asta's broken, so... And that's all I have to say about that. Nick's thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, there's some cool bits here and there. I guess I just need to maybe see what these guys are. Again, it's tough to really have be too engaged by, like, an Asta countered their, like, I'm like, oh, it's, you know, an interesting idea that Asta countered their hex magic by cutting his wound, essentially nullifying it. But it's one of those things, like, you know, we've seen him basically cancel every magic thus far. Like, he basically does, like, once per chapter. So it's one of those things where I'm like, eh, it's hard to really engage me with that at this point. I think you need to get away from Asta cutting and negating things and get to something else at this point. Like, let's get back to Fuego Leon, or, God, if we need to, let's go see what Charmy's doing. I assume eating.
Probably. Okay. Bleach 646, The Second Eye. So we have this bullshit, pointless four or five page long conversation about how they're leaving Shinsui behind. Everyone's like, shouldn't we stay behind and help him? And Hiraka is like, what? We didn't stay behind and help Isagi, so why should we help Shinsui?
He doesn't say it, but he really should have. Also, he has another one of those great Bleach lines where people do not talk this way, because he's like, Will, one more question. Uke Taki was here. What do you think he'd say? And then he, like, cuts, like, a flashback of Uke Taki saying, like, if Kyoraku says he'll be okay, then he'll be okay. Let's just leave it to him and go. And it cuts back to Sokka fucking Sokka. He's like, that's the correct answer. So we obviously see, like, yeah, that's the correct answer. For everyone else who's there, though, they didn't, like, it's not like that flashback showed up on a screen in front of them. It's like he just stood there and was like, what do you think Uketake would say if he's here? That's the correct answer.
He just, like, looks to the side for a little while, and everyone's staring at him all weird. He's like, what is he doing?
And he's like, that's the correct answer. Everyone's like, I guess we all must have been on the same page. And I just like, I like to think Renji's in the background. He's just like, who's Uketake? That's the correct answer.
My captain, you asshole!
But you've already responded.
That sad look that Hidemori gets on her face after Hiraka says that's the correct answer. It's like, oh, my captain's insane. I wish Captain Aizen were still here. I know he betrayed us all, but he made more sense than Hiraka does.
He's somewhere out there. Holy shit, we haven't seen Aizen.
Where's like, Aizen?
Like 5 months.
And then they go on, by the way, also while we're at it, if Ginyu Ryusai was the one staying behind, he would say to go on without him, too.
Like, well, that's because he's a shitty leader.
And Yamamoto died because he thought that way. So then finally, we cut. By the way, Nanao has showed up to tell them all this. And then she's like, all right, and I'm going to head back now.
Later.
So again, as we mentioned last week, she followed after Shunsui so that she could then go back to the rest of the group, so that she could then go back to Shunsui.
Pretty sure that
they didn't need her to tell them, by the way, Shunsui's finding this guy. They could have probably figured it out by the fact that he flash-stepped away after he was shot.
Yeah. And to this point, isn't there some kind of fucking, like, communication system in this series?
They had butterflies, damn it!
I was like, I feel like you shouldn't be at the point where, like, this super awesome Soul Society isn't like, yeah, there were radios and Naruto and fucking One Piece uses snails to communicate.
Where are Jinjo and Tsukishima?
You're the only person asking that question. And it's only from a place of anger. The fuck, why won't these guys show up? They have all the phones!
Unohana's dead, Chris, and she's never coming back! Okay. So last time, Shinsui was like, I cut your sniper rifle because my swords play children's games. And as we all know, children's games change in the blink of an eye because children have ADD, basically. And so, I'm out of breath because I'm yelling so much. I'm getting lightheaded.
You're like, I've exhausted myself.
Bleach is so stupid. So Lily Barrow is like, blarg. And part of Lily Barrow's gun just suddenly drops to the ground. We don't see anything happen. Shinsui just says, Omaiwa Moshinderu, you've already been cut. And the barrel of his gun drops to the floor as Leobaro dives away. And she's like, I thought I cut your entire arm off. Well, that's not, you know, a difficult expectation to have. And speech, but anyway. So she was like, but I guess I missed. And so suddenly Leobar just kind of makes this motion on his gun. We don't actually see what he does. He just like...
It's like he just pulls the rest of the gun out of the fucking fur.
And that is, I guess, what we're meant to interpret as what happened. Like, he formed the gun right there. But we don't see anything happen. We just see him in one frame with his hand on the gun. And the next frame, suddenly, it's gripping the barrel of a freshly formed gun. We don't see the gun in any way reappear or anything like that. And he's like, oh, Diagram, this gun is my bow. It is made from my reishi. He's like, okay, makes sense. All right. But you've already forgotten the rules. And Shinsui attacks him from behind. He's like, oh, see, you caught a glimpse of my shadow, and everything you saw after that, blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 blah.
Blah, 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 blah.
Remember when you were a kid, you were afraid to death of the silhouette that kept following you? Who the fuck is afraid of their own shadow? Pussies, that's who!
Like, fucking Shinsui's stupid-ass explanation of kids' games. Like, what kids' games did you play? I was never afraid of my own shadow. None of these seem like rules. You're an asshole with a bullshit Shikai.
So he
But it's okay, because you're about to be countered by an equally bullshit power.
So Shinsui summons a whole bunch of clones of himself, because apparently shadows do that now. He stabs Liubaro from behind through the chest, and Liubaro goes, oh, damn it. That's the third time. Which is like, what? Only when both my eyes are open can I exercise the quintessence of the X-axis. In other words, my shots penetrate your body, and my body penetrates your blades. There's way too much penetration going on between these two. It's gonna get X-rated now, if you know what I mean. Oh, X-pun!
Did you work on that one, or was that...
No, I came up with it just now. Oh. But that's okay. Kubo's expending just as much effort in this scene as me. So, Shinsui's like, oh, when both of your eyes are open, my logic no longer applies.
Why?
Yes, in this moment, there is no weapon in this world that can kill me because I just put God mode into Counter-Strike.
What does this mean? I do not understand what he's talking about. He's like, when my eye opens, I'm just unbeatable? Is that what he's literally saying?
Time to 360 no-scope. I am allowed to open both my eyes only in the brief moment I fall into crisis in a battle. Basically, when my 12-year-old psyche gets sick of better people beating me, then I'm just like, I am to God, Lulzors, I win. No, I am not hacking. No, don't ban me. So he's like, it wouldn't be fair to the sinners if I kept both my eyes open. Who cares? You're in a war.
Yeah.
And Shinsui's like, could you close it then? However, only when I open my eyes three times in one battle am I allowed to continue fighting with them open. I guess he opened them twice more before this? I don't know. I wasn't paying attention. Who cares? I am the last Quincy His Majesty granted power to, except your X instead of Z. Apparently, Yubak did not know the alphabet very well. Also, he had a 27 letter in there somewhere, too.
Or he just fucking said fuck it and forgot about Zombie Girl, whoever the Y was.
His Majesty's masterpiece, the one closest to God. To have my eyes open three times, that is utterly unacceptable. And he does his whole Quincy release thing. And he turns into a bullet with wings, basically. This is just as stupid as Omari turning from the fastest of the fucking Espada into a pumpkin. He turns from a sniper into a bullet with wings.
I looked at it like he was some kind of Swiss cheese angel. Like,
he does look like a cheese grater, sort of, too.
He was just covered in holes for some random reason. I cannot... First and foremost, Yuhabak is a terrible giver of powers, because he seems to give them to the worst people. Like, oh, this is the power of unlimited imagination into reality. I shall give it to the most unimaginative person in my army. Ah, the power of God mode that you can activate at will should you desire it. I shall give it to the person in my army who will most resist the temptation to activate it at whim and choose to have a fair fight.
Because he is a bullshit camper.
Just give give it to fucking the people who are going to abuse the shit out of these powers. You suck, dude.
So he's like, oh, now I am Ziliel, which means divine judgment. And Shinsui's like, I better move. Oh, wait, I can't move. And suddenly he gets shot 3 times because apparently those holes in Ziliel's wings can shoot bullets too. So Shinsui's tilt's dead now, right? The fight's over because he's been shot by bullets that before killed you one hit, one kill style. And he's been shot twice in the body and once in the hat. So, and if you shoot him in the hat, he's totally going to die.
Yeah, that's the one. That was the killer shot right there. Actually, it looks like none of the shots actually hit him because one looks like it's going over his shoulder.
One hits his shoulder and one grazes his ribs. Is this going to be like another thing where it's just like, yeah, I stopped having a sniper's accuracy and it just kind of like, I'm not very accurate in this form because I don't practice with it much because I'm only allowed to open my eyes so many times. It's, yeah. So just give me a chance to get used to this, please. Yeah. Yeah.
It's such a stupid chapter.
Such a stupid series.
I just, man, I cannot wait till the end of the year when we get to our year-end recap, because I can't wait to be like, Nick, I want us to just note where we were at the beginning of the year and where we are at the end of the year, and you tell me what's happened thus far.
It's been a bullshit, bunch of bullshit, that's what.
In the past year, what's happened? I think Aizen coming back is literally the only plot progression this series has had thus
that's
far
so
this
sad.
Year.
Sad. Oh, God. Okay. Yeah.
Alright, so I'll take over here for a little bit, Nick. When we jump into Fairy Tail, chapter 456, Orders. And our cover page is a nice little description of all the different things that are happening.
Nice little One Piece style recap of people's positions and stuff.
Yes, it is very handy. So we open up with the dragon team fighting, what is their name? Ajeel? Not Ajeel. It's, fuck. They say it too. Who cares? They're two guys who don't matter. Bakel and some other dude. They're basically having a little square off and, you know, happy notes to Natsu. Like, hey, why aren't you giving it your all here? Go get serious. You can take this guy down in no time. And Natsu responds with, like, yeah, I could. But we don't know how many fights I'm going to be in after this, so I can't go all out right from the start. And Happy's like, oh, the first time ever Natsu's thinking about the future. My little boy is growing up. Which I thought
I really
was funny.
Like that. I really like that.
It's a funny little scene.
It's nice to show character progression and a nice little joke there.
Yes. Yeah. Then Carla pushes him away and gives us, like, a shot that I think is a panty
shot. Through my stockings.
I'm trying not to look at it hard enough to tell if it is. It's unnecessary enough regardless. There's a little bit of action there, besides we'll get our fan service at the end of this. If it's not, don't worry. And we cut back into the city where we see Gray and, what do they call her, Urza. What the fuck is her name? Why am I blanking?
Juvia.
Gray and Juvia are fighting, and then Elfman and their group shows up. Mary Jane reveals that she took Sela, I guess that's the name, one of the demons from the last arc. Basically, she was going to die, so Mary Jane said, I'll take your body instead so it can be of use to us. And she uses her demonic macro powers to basically put out a whole bunch of the invading army forces, just put them right to sleep. Then she also says, we get to, like, those are the ones that we get to punt. Like, the ones that didn't get knocked out, those are the ones we get to beat up.
A stupid little wink to the camera.
Yeah, I don't quite get that. I was like, shit's getting kind of real for you guys. Maybe you should take it a little bit more seriously.
This is my new demonic form, and I demand that all of you minions sleep. And I was like, oh man, that's so awesome, but there's more coming. Well, we're just going to have to punch those guys. It's like, what the fuck?
And Elfman's cry, like, it's so manly. I'm like,
no, it's
really?
Not!
The wink and the heart at the end was super manly.
Let me tell you something, man. When I think of fucking Kenshiro, after he would, you know, punch you in the brain with his fingers, and then you were like, you are already dead. After I give you a little punch, wink.
Wink, wink.
Yeah, manliest thing ever.
Buddy.
Fuck off, Elfman.
There's a lot of other small scenes here. We see Wall doing, you know, talk about, like, oh, one of those curses, and a little bit of Ajeel versus Urza. Nothing really new from that, just kind of cutting to them. We cut back to the command center, where Warren is basically being ordered, like, you need to make commands right now. He doesn't want to, he's kind of scared.
You
so
know any of these people are.
Another character kicks him in the dick, and is like, you need to fucking buck up, because I'm scared too, but we gotta fight, this is our home! And he's really passionate for a character whose name I don't know.
This guy is like
Max?
A little bit. I think this is like last guy's on the list of people I expected to be given a full half a page close up in Fairy Tail.
It's like after this guy, it's the Indian dude, and then there's the fat guy who could draw things on his stomach, but then he got skinnies and like, you kind of broke your own power, dude. And then Warren kind of shoves a broom up the other guy's butt because he's like, how dare you kick me in the dick? But he gets his nerves together, starts issuing orders, and then they have a fight over the fact that they're kicking each other in the dick and slamming things up each other's buttholes. Meanwhile, Makarov's just like, I'm sorry, I have a lot of issues in my
account. I'm a terrible guild leader, I realize now after seeing those two fucktards.
Well, I don't know why we made them Captain Commander and Vice Admiral Leader. Those aren't even real positions.
And Mavis is just like, well, you have been the Guildmaster 3 times now, so...
she notes that she has to come up with a new strategy because the moment they give in, that's when they'll lose everything. So she has to come up with something new.
Okay, but now we've got to get to the most important part of the chapter, Chris.
So we cut back to Lucy's place, where, if you recall, Nick, we found out that... Three members of the Sprinkin' 12 were already coming in on the city, and two of them were already inside, because Wall just used his magic nullifying powers to break straight in, walk right in, really casually, and Brandish somehow ended up naked in Lucy's bathtub. And
I can only assume she shrunk herself down
so yeah,
she could sneak inside.
Yeah, snuck in through the sewer pipe, something like that. They didn't show that because that's not erotic. It's super erotic is her being naked in a bathtub and asking Lucy to get in. Yeah, because that's what she does. She's like, get in here with me. I don't know why Lucy's response is like, why? No, not this again. But, you know, she's trying to be like, why do you want me to do that? And Brandish's like, oh, is it this guy? Is he what's weirding you out here? I'll put him in a container I had somewhere. I don't know where. I'm naked. I guess I just emptied out one of your shampoo containers and put him in it.
That would make sense.
I guess. But then I'm like, oh, did she just drown him in shampoo then? Which would be kind of amusing.
Yeah, it would be nice. You know, get rid of that stupid pervert, man.
Anyway, she continues to push the point. Get in here with me. Because she says, the moment I entered this town, you and your people lost. Because you remember my magic, right? I can reduce this town to nothing in a second. A single snap of my fingers, poof, gone. But you know, I'm kind of enjoying this bath, so I'm not doing it. Are you getting my meaning?
And to make a point, she like snaps her fingers and there's this rumbling. Lucy's like, what just happened? I shrunk the building next door.
Yeah. A little demonstration for you. And she says, this is your last chance. Get in the bath. That's an order. And Lucy starts to take off her clothes and she thinks to herself, I can't beat her with magic. I don't know what she's up to. Let's play it in her way. I'll do this battle naked. To be continued in chapter 457, Battle of the Nudes.
I am in about 5 minds about this scene. First of all, it's stupid.
It's beyond dumb.
Second of all, it's so stupid that it's eating its own ass. Third of all, Hero has gone so stupid that I can't hate it.
I'm both amazed and at the same time, I am not surprised this happened.
Well, and fourth of all, I'm actually kind of curious about this now. Well, because not in the obvious sense. I don't need to see any more of Hero's crafted cleavage and butts and etc.
Yes,
I don't need to see Hero draw any. There's nothing. Even if I have been titillated at the beginning, there's nothing Hero can do now to titillate me now.
Here's the thing that's interesting.
He's done it so much. He's pumped that well dry. That said, I'm like, huh. Well, this means that Brandish is actually getting a little bit of character kind of shown. It's like, why doesn't she want to fight? Actually going to want to find out about that.
I hope it's just she's like, oh, this bat's really comfortable. I want you to get in here with me and we can massage each other.
Yeah, it could be as simple
something.
As that, but it's also like, well, she also let them go when she first encountered them. Does she have her own little agenda? Does she not want to just kill off Fairy Tail and stuff? What's going on with her? And the fact that the super fan service character in the Sprinkin' 12 is the one that's getting that is so fucking amusing to me.
Here's the thing I find so amusing. In Food Wars this week, there is a scene as well where Erna is getting into a bath. So there's a bath scene in both of these manga this week. The one drawn by an actual porn artist is so much less titillating than the one in fucking Fairy Tail. There's, like, nothing you really see in the Food Wars one, but this one, it's like, we're gonna do this battle naked! It's so, like, I'm not surprised by it. It's just amusing me, because I'm like, I guess this is where you have to go. You've gone so far out of your way to hit upon these different fetishes before. Like, of course there's an S&M fucking master in the Last Guild. Of course we'd have this battle naked in your bathtub. Why would Lucy need something different?
Lucy cannot go a single arc without being naked. Like, she just can't.
But it's like, it's almost like, it's almost creepy too, because it's like she's just ordering, like, get naked and get in this tub. Like, just do it, or I'll kill everyone. But it's just one of those things, like, I can't, like, there's nothing to this. There's no layers beneath this. There's nothing
that we know of, Chris.
Like, I won't be one of those Reddit people that's like, I'll eat a hat if the Yankees lose this game. But I will say, like, I strongly believe that there is nothing to this than just fan service next week.
I am trying to focus on those pauses. Like, oh, is there something going on with Brandish, basically, as opposed to she felt like being naked because Hiro wanted to draw her naked. Yeah. I want to believe.
Like, that's so much hope. You're the Tenma of this podcast. Like, always thinking optimistically, and I need to come in like the Johan of this series. Like, you'll do it, Nick. I'm going to tell you, next week you're going to say that this series sucks, and once you do that, it's all over. Fucking the manga hope for this series dies with your condemnation of it.
I believe a year ago we established that I think that Fairy Tail is stupid, but I love it anyway, so... Anyway.
Oh, God.
Let us move on now. Oh, my God. This was the best / worst chapter of Fairy Tail in a while. Okay. Let's move on now to Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 138. Erina comes to Polaris. We get a cover page. There's nothing to do with the rest of the chapter. It's Rindo just kind of sitting on a couch. I get the impression that the creators, or at the very least, Seiki Shun, the artist, really likes Rindo, because he seems to draw her a lot, even though she doesn't do a lot.
Maybe because she has fangs. Fangs seem like a thing he doesn't get to draw.
Yeah, that is a weird, like, not fetish, but recurring thing a lot of people think is cute. It's one of those kind of things that...
vampires are kawaii desu, to be fair.
She's going to start sparkling the next time she does this. Anywho. So, Erina and company have come in from the rain, and Soma shows up as well. And he's like, Akiri's here. It's like, bluntly, he's like, huh, Akiri's here. And they're all like, yeah, we are. And, Hisako basically explained the situation, and so it was like, oh, wow, so where are the others? Well, Alice and Nanare have gone home, and there's a little caption next to them, and it was like, bailed.
Yeah. They just booked it.
Well, Alice was like, oh, I'm sure that Erina will be safe.
She was like, there's somewhere else that's out of my responsibility. Okay, thanks, bye! Oh my god, this place is boring.
So they're like, oh, Erina, you know, you should go and take a bath and warm up and stuff. Meanwhile, back at the Nakiri residence, someone reports to his zombie that Erina is gone. And he says, it seems that Miss Alice has taken her somewhere. Shall I dispatch a search party? And as I was like, that's Alice for you.
Well, I do like that. He's like, that's Alice. Like, he's not angry. Like, he's just like, well, what'd you expect? That's Alice. Yeah. Always very quick and, you know, quick to action.
So the aide is like, well, doesn't, you know, Miss Erina have tasting duties tomorrow? And Azami says, well, I think I'd like to respect Erina's actions, so cancel everything until she chooses to return. And he's like, well, then I'll have to, I guess, apologize to our clients then. Yes, and? Okay, good. I think I want to find out more about this poor aide guy who's stuck with this awful family.
It's like, I hate my life.
But it's a surprising reaction, though. He's just like, no, I'm sure she'll come back. It's just one of those things where I guess it just goes back to that thing we said in the last couple of chapters. He's just so convinced everything's just going to work out in his favor. He doesn't have to get freaked out that Eren is gone for one night. She'll be back. She'll be back. And then we get that bath scene with Eren, which, well, I'm pretty sure Shinseki did really want to draw this scene.
He's like, all right, I've done a lot of food shit. I've done a lot of Shokugekis.
I've done a lot of food shit without people's clothes exploding off.
Yeah.
Let me draw Eren's cleavage.
I want 2 pages. And okay. To be fair, though, this is not nearly as titillating as, like, it could have been. Like, it could have been a lot more gratuitous than this.
Yeah. And it does seem like Eren really needs to kind of relax, I guess. You can sort of see something is, like, melting off of her while this is going on. Like, it's obvious that she's been through a lot recently, and she needs to recover from it. Whether it's by going back to her father, or by sticking with this plan her friends have thought up for her, she's been through some stress, and so she needed this just not just to warm up, but also just to kind of give herself some time to collect herself. Mm-hmm. That said, Shinseki's like, there's her cleavage, guys! She's 14.
Is she?
She's 15, I believe.
I was going to say, like, is high school in Japan that young?
She might even be 16. She's in her first year of high school. High school in Japan is 3 years. They started at, like, 15 and finished at 18. So, but anyway, yeah. So Hisako tells everyone in the Polaris dorm, could you please let Miss Eren hide here for a while? And so everyone's like, I do feel bad because, it's the stuff going on with her family. But, if we start something with the Nikiri family, we might be in trouble. Oh, we could get arrested for kidnapping, and so on and so forth. Isako's like, all right, I'll tell you the whole story. But, you shouldn't tell anyone outside this room. And Eren comes out, and she's like, oh, thank you for letting me use the bath. Everyone's just like, oh, Nikiri is! Like, bombarding her with sad faces. And I fucking love that. I was just like, oh, no, if I want to get involved. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry you went through that. Bunch of softies. Except for Soma, who's like...
And Ishiki. Oh. Ishiki doesn't seem to be crying either.
Ishiki's like, let's welcome our guest, guys. And
she hasn't had dinner yet. Oh, great. Yeah.
So, everyone's like, oh, just stay as long as you need to, blah, blah. And Ishiki says, oh, have you had supper? Well, then Polaris Dorm will welcome a special guest tonight. I think this calls for a party. And one of the less important characters, whose name I forget.
I was going to say, I don't think I believe the series, I don't know this guy.
I believe we saw him briefly during the Stagiaire Week, but he's one of the less, like, even in terms of the gang that Megumi and Soma would hang out with, he is one of the less important characters. And so he's like, here's something simple for you. White fish, slow cooked in butter on low heat, and so on and so forth. How'd you like it? And Eren says, well, the natural flavors of the ingredients are adequately retained. Oh, yeah. However, and she goes, I can't read all of this.
It's like
6 paragraphs. She gives him, off the cuff, a full food editorial article, basically. Like, just, think of that one character in Ratatouille. The food editorial guy. Imagine if he had a 5-minute scene to dress someone down. She does that and caps it all off with, it is utterly unacceptable. But more than just, instead of just being like, everyone in the dorm is just like, all right, you're going to try my dorm. We're gonna defeat that divine tongue of yours. We're going to show you, and so on and so forth. And Eren is completely caught off guard by this. And she's just, she's taken aback by everyone. She's just like, oh, at least form a line. And it was like, hey, try mine next. Did you hear what I just said? Form a line.
I do love that, like, She's like, I don't want to try all your... And, like, they all just, like, start getting excited. She's like, all right, fine, just form a line, at least. Like, give me the least, the nice, the slightest of fucking of considerations on this. And still, like, not even fucking doing that.
And so Soma comes in, and he's drying himself off from the ring. He's like, oh, so does that mean if I get mine, you'll try some of my food, too? I already made it clear I have no intention of ever tasting your food ever again. And a fucking random breeze comes in and blows by him. Oh, God. So entertaining. And, yeah, everyone's just, like, you know, bombarding Aaron with requests. And so Soma kind of goes to the side of the room where Kisako is observing everything. And he's like, oh, she's such a Scrooge. But Kisako says, maybe, but she's actually changing little by little. She's become much calmer and more at peace. And Soma's like, really? She seems just as bitchy as always. Snippy and prickly are his exact words, but yeah.
Bitchy would be in the shoujo or the Seinen Jump version of this.
Right. So
Hisako, maybe cunty, but
Hisako says, "Well, it's obvious to me. You know, when I met her, she was lovely to me, but I sensed something shadowed and cold about her too. And ever since then, little by little, she's changed." And we see, you know, the kind of little flashbacks from Hisako's perspective of her sitting at a table with Soma and Kurikiba and Alice and Hayama and such, and then, you know, hanging out with them later on, you know, being bothered by Soma to try his pork buns, and now being surrounded by everyone at Polaris. And Hisako looks so happy that her friend's doing well and stuff.
It's a very sweet scene, because I love the way this was presented to us, because we got that shot of Erina, where she has that angle of, like, this food's utterly unacceptable. And it's done in that way that at the start of the series, it was that antagonistic, fuck you, this is absolutely horrible, you're worthless angle. But in this, because we're kind of showing that Erina has evolved since then, and she's not as cool of a person, it motivates everybody. And then you get to see, like, oh, and the way that it's all these people are interacting around her, it really does feel like, oh, this is a character who, after suffering so much as a child, after all of the acts that made her a closed-off, cruel, outward, bitter person, she is around people that are opening her up, and she is having a good time. You genuinely get that feeling. It's a very good case of showing the audience that instead of just being like, no, she has a bunch of friends now. Like, I really do get the impression, like, this is a fun event that she's at, even if she seems exasperated. Like, it's
yeah, she's being sun-sun to everybody, kind of, but she's not, you know, being like, no, all your food is bullshit. So it's like, okay, fine, I'll eat all your food. Yeah. So. And someone's like, oh, you know, you've mellowed out too, Hisako, and stuff. But then eventually Erina kind of observes them talking to each other, and she approaches them, and she's like, during the Stagiaire Challenge, you two seem to have gotten friendlier. And someone's like, what? What? Can I ask you what happened between you?
He just, like, bumbles away to the point he's just like,
what are you talking about, Nahiri? But then everyone's like, hey, Yukihira, you should make something too. Make one of your weird ones. And Enter's like, I asked you a question. Did you really? But someone just ties his apron on, and for a brief moment when she looks at him from behind at the same angle she would see his father from, he actually reminds her of Juichiro. And so what catches her looking, he's like, oh, what is it? He's like, nothing! Just so you're aware, I will touch nothing you've cooked! Oh, well.
No, like that. Like, no, not gonna be anything you did. So saving that, Nick. It's gonna be a big event later on.
So eventually, Hisako actually leaves. She goes back because obviously if she and Erina stay together, then it'll just bring more suspicion there. So at the door, as she's, you know, preparing to leave, she says, you know, take care of Miss Erina. And someone says, though, even if I don't do much, everyone else here probably will. And they're getting ready to play a card game. And Erina's like,
She's Tim Allen for a moment. Little hat appears from over the fence, like, hey, what's going on, everybody in Polaris dorm?
And so Soma says, well, I hope that, you know, running away gets her father to open his eyes some. And Hisako says, well, I doubt that it's going to work out so conveniently. You see, Miss Erina is the key to Master Azami's new plan. We pan forward to the next morning as Azami is at a meeting with a whole bunch of old men. And they're like, what is this? And he says, under my administration, this will be the new instruction method at Totsuki.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, I mean, we kind of knew that something along these lines would happen. But this thing about Erina being the key is interesting, because, like, well, what does that mean? Is he going to be used to judge the quality of the professors who are teaching or some shit? I don't really know. It's not like he can have her oversee every single Shokugeki or whatever, you know. Every single test. Feed it to Miss Erina!
But in this school, we're actually going to start to see what Azumi's plans for the school are. Mm-hmm. So, I imagine it's going to be even more strict than what we've seen in the past. Like, it's like, if anyone doesn't get an A, they'll get expelled or something like that. Like, it's going to be crazy strict.
And, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, it was nice to see just the progression of Erina and stuff. Like I said, I think when we first started recapping the series earlier, I was looking forward to when Erina would finally get more heavily involved in the series, and now we got that, and it's been quite interesting just to see this shell around her breaking and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I really look forward to seeing where this goes. But for now, let us continue on to My Hero Academia.
Yes.
Which had
popularity poll.
Yeah, announced the results of the popularity poll. So we get a 3 color pages, with like prominently featuring the top 10 characters, but also little glimpses of like, oh, you know. Here are these 2 characters who were in 20th place. You know, there's the Invisible Girl and the Inventor Girl. Yairozu got 11th place, and Mineta got 18th place, and so on and so forth. But also, I love the little notes that are given as well. Like, Midoriya's shoes earned a vote. And so Yairozu is, like, holding up one of Deku's shoes, and it goes, woo! And Naruto got 1 vote for some reason. Also Katsura from Gintama. Even characters from the creator's previous series got votes.
But none from Barrage.
What's wrong with you people? Fuck Japan.
Yeah, like, this is the one big injustice of this character poll. This My Hero Academia poll. No Barrage characters on it.
And even Horikoshi Kohei got 17th place. What weird sense of humor the Japanese voters have. But the top 10 are Kaminari got 10th place, the lightning guy, who actually hasn't done a whole lot, but I guess he was heavily involved in the invasion that happened during that early test, I guess. Aizawa, the homeroom teacher, is 9th place. It's not in order, so I'm having a hard time tracking
Ida
down.
Ida is 8th place.
Ida?
Tokoyami at 7th. Then Asui, the frog girl.
Fifth place is All Might. Yeah. Fourth place is, the top 5 are pretty understandable. All Might, Uraraka, Bakugo, Todoroki, and Deku. And yes. Reverse order there. So
the very interesting thing, though, is then we see the U.S. results, or the English-speaking results, I guess I should say. And this is the one that we all got in the character survey or the issue survey a couple months back. And number 1 still Midoriya. Number 2 is the frog girl.
Oh, she's pretty awesome.
Blows my mind, though. The number 2 character in the series.
I think that people just really like her design and her personality and stuff.
I can't name a thing. She's like, I think she's cool, but I can't think like what devoted fan base does she have? Because it is impressive. She's, like, got the Cesaro section or something. Just some group of, like, Frog Girl fans!
When is Suyu going to get her push?
I love it there.
Well, yeah, the top 6 results are basically just mixed around from the Japanese results. And then Stain's number 8.
Yeah.
Apparently Japan don't like Stain, but America does.
We're shallow.
Oh, boy. Anyhow, getting back into the actual events that are going on in this series. Chapter 62 is titled Katsuki Bakugo Origin. As, of course, Bakugo and Deku are in the middle of their test where they have to work together to take on All Might, but Bakugo doesn't want to work together. And All Might has this weird, pretty villainous line where he says, "Who cares about keeping this town intact? Think of this as a mere test, and you're going to have a bad time." Apparently All Might was watching South Park before this. "I'm a villain, heroes, so give me your best shot." So, yeah. And he rushes in to attack them, and Deku's like, "We can't fight him! Let's just run! You're not the boss of me!" Oh, God. And All Might just kind of, like, talks out loud. He just grabs Bakugo by the face. Fucking awesome. Just lunges in, shakes off the grenade, and attacks him. And then Bakugo just raises his hand up straight to All Might's face and says, "I was expecting this!" This hits him over and over with explosions, and All Might's going, "Ow, ow, 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 ow." It's such a weird, tense, but humorous scene. What the hell is with the dialogue in this scene? It's so weird. South Park references. Ow, 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 ows. Like, what the fuck? Oh, no. But All Might does give Bakugo some credit mentally. He's like, "Oh, you know, a lot of people, when they have their faces grabbed, they just try and instinctively get away, but this kid is dead set on beating me and nothing else." So, yeah, nice little note of Bakugo's mental state. And then he kind of tosses Bakugo aside and goes after Deku next. And he says, "All right, so are you going to leave your teammate and make a break for it?" And all of a sudden, Deku remembers Stain, specifically Stain's face, without the mask on and stuff. And he's like, "Oh, why am I thinking of him at this time?" Which I guess it might just be because he's scared shitless? I'm not sure. Maybe he's thinking of the situation he landed in where Stain was holding, where he had to choose between protecting the people who were confronting Stain. I don't know.
Well, it's just the notion of, are you going to stay and fight someone you can't beat, or are you going to leave and try to take your friend with you? Like, it's the same situation he had with Stain. Like, do you get out of here, or do you fight and potentially save your friends?
So Deku tries to jump backwards away, and All Might kind of observes this thing happening right before it actually does. He's like, "Oh, well, that's just unfortunate." As Bakugo comes rushing in, he's like, "Ah, move it!" And they bump heads in midair. Oh, God. Cure Girl is like, observes, "Oh, you know, one wants to beat All Might and the other wants to run." And Deku sees All Might as this idol being unimaginably powerful, and, you know, he's like a god. But then there's this one. "I don't know much about him, but judging from his grace and performance at the sports festival, he's gifted with incredible talent. So why is he so worked up?" And Deku says, you know, it's like, "You're never going to beat him." But Bakugo says, "I will win. That's what heroes do." And he remembers when he idolized All Might as a kid, when Bakugo idolized him as a kid. All Might's so cool. And Deku says, "Look, we can't fight here, not like this." And Bakugo is again, you know, like, "Oh, get away from me." And All Might does something very cruel, kind of, where he gets this guardrail and uses it to trap Deku against the ground, and then just starts wailing on Bakugo, punches him in the stomach to the point he actually pukes up a little and sends him flying.
Oh, it's not a little. I was shocked they showed as much of this as they did, because it's basically like a, you know, a full panel of him just vomiting all over himself, and the rest of the chapter you see the vomit residue still stuck to his mouth. It's
quite nasty.
Shockingly gratuitous for this series.
And there is a moment where he has to catch himself and just puke up a little bit more because he's been hit so hard in the gut. And then we get more flashback to way back when Bakugo and Deku actually were friends, or at least on friendly terms with each other. And Bakugo is like, "Oh, look at, you know, see, you know, All Might's totally the coolest. It's 4-on-1. There's no way he can win. But look, see, dodge, punch, fate. See, he won. No matter how bad it looks, he always wins in the end." And All Might's, you know, trying to get to the core of Bakugo's personality problems. He's like, this is about Midoriya's incredible growth, right? But, you know, when he starts at level 1 and you're at level 50, of course the growth rates are going to be different. Don't throw it all away. Don't you see? You've got to grow.
You've got to grind on fucking hordes of Geodudes to make sure you get enough defense EVs.
Come on.
You're not going to be a special wall like that.
But it's not a matter of power for you. And let's see here. Oh, okay. So I'm trying to figure out. Oh, Deku's thinking about All Might, I guess, in this thought, where he says, "You're a nasty guy, but it's true. No matter what you come up against, you always try to win." Oh, no, he's thinking that about Bakugo. Of course, duh. I knew this for the first time I read it, but I forgot. Whatever. You know, he's like, I know that about you. You always try to win, and that's why I look up to you. Which is, you know, nice to kind of be reminded of, that Deku did want to be friends with Bakugo for a long time and stuff. And he still does. Bakugo's just been such an asshole to him the whole time, so. And Bakugo says, you know, shut up, All Might. If you're saying I gotta rely on his help, then I'd rather lose. Finally, Deku manages to break free from the guardrail, goes flying and shoots straight past All Might and punches Bakugo right across the face. It looks like he should have broken his neck from the way his head whips around from it, actually.
And considering that was how much strength he has, I wouldn't be shocked if that should have happened. Like, oh no, I just killed my friend. Oops.
I was just trying to snap him out of it. And Deku says, "You'd rather lose? That doesn't sound like you. Whether we try to beat All Might or run from him, I honestly can't think of a single plan." He's like dragging him along as he tries to run away. "But why not try using me before giving up? I don't want to hear you say it's fine if we lose. The one who never throws in the towel till he's won is you, isn't it?" And he remembers when they were kids and Bakugo took on these bullies and he just fought them until he won all by himself. And, you know, as Deku was observing him, Bakugo just said to himself, you know, the strongest heroes always win in the end. I guess this is really the most insight into Bakugo's, you know, character and why he wanted to be a hero as before. And you can see why he has that tremendous competitive streak to him is because the thing that he took from All Might was just that he always won. And so you gotta wonder, is like, okay, does that mean that he is going to maybe descend to the dark side if it means he'll get stronger? Or does it mean that he, more than a lot of people, understands how important it is to be strong? Because like, oh, you know, no matter what bad situation he goes up against, he'll always stand on top of the end because he's a hero or something. So, a couple of ways that they could still go, and I'm intrigued by this. Mm-hmm. So eventually All Might runs after, you know, he's running after them, and he finally catches up to them as Bakugo attacks him from behind with some explosive bursts, and All Might catches a glimpse of Bakugo's face. He's got this really weird, contorted, miserable expression on, and he's like thinking to himself, "Oh, this takes me off so bad to think I'd have to do this with you." And he shouts out to Deku, and Deku comes up from behind All Might. Now he's turned around, and he's got Bakugo's other grenade gauntlet on his arm. And he pulls the pin to shoot All Might from behind. I thought this was really cool.
It's a good chapter. I mean, it shows a good amount of the growth that seemingly happened between the two. And I like what we kind of get. It's interesting to get the perspective again that, like, Ed is, not at his core, but at the crux of his initial development, Bakugo wanted to be a hero. You know, he didn't just end up being super powerful and be like, well, I guess I'll go to the Hero Academy. He went to the Hero Academy because, like anyone else who went there, he wanted to be a hero when he grew up. He happened to get a super strong power, and because of that, he developed strength, and then that power kind of corrupted him. He started treating others that were weaker than him like shit, and just became the bully, what we all know. But in his mind, he still thinks he's a hero. He still wants to be a hero. He maybe doesn't realize that he's doing very unheroic things a lot of the time, but he wants to be a hero. And that is kind of portrayed in this chapter. I think, well, my only issue was the whiplash between last chapter and this one, because I almost feel like the relationship the two have in this one makes no sense considering the way they reacted last chapter to each other. Last chapter really felt like an abusive relationship. Like, the two of them just fucking wanted to murder each other. Whereas this one, you're like, no, they're antagonistic toward each other. It's a bully and his victim who have now kind of both grown, but the victim's grown to a place where he really can stand up to him, and they're just trying to work things out as two people who are kind of like rival enemies. I don't know what you call rivalries. I don't know.
Frenemies.
Frenemies. But it works on that regard to a certain extent. It's not perfectly what it is. I think it really works against what happened last chapter, because that was such a, like, strong, these two people fucking hate each other. But I do like that this chapter shows Bakugo
One, showing that he ultimately had admirations of being a hero when he grew up, and that's still the motivation he has for himself. And two, that he did work forward in this chapter. He does let Deku work in the strategy. There's some plan they come up that probably Deku came up with, too.
I do agree that there were probably... It did feel like there were pacing issues. I think that maybe this would have been better if it had been drawn out across two chapters or a chapter and a half or something like that. But just, you know, having the individual moments that make it up did really hit me strong. Like, you know, when Deku thinks to himself, you know, that's who you are. No matter what, you always try to win. And that's why I look up to you and stuff. And the moments of Bakugo watching All Might when he was a kid and stuff. I thought those were very strong. And also the final bit where they put this plan together and Deku was wearing one of Bakugo's gauntlets. I thought was really cool. Mm-hmm. But yeah, could have been better, but I like it at score.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Let's move on to One Piece, chapter 803, Elephant Climbing. So, everyone on the Luffy Go has found the Sunny Go. Bartolomeo's crew starts chanting, "We're not worthy! We're not worthy!" Because, of course, they do. But, of course, they observe that the ship is completely empty, so they must be on the elephant. And, so, yeah. But at that moment, Bartolomeo is like, "Alright, well, you know, we have to go now, and until the day we meet again, we will all strive to be worthy of claiming the title of Straw Hat Affiliation." And he's like, "Oh, and by the way, should we find each other again, it would be the greatest of ours if we got the last four autographs from the pens of gods." Bartolomeo is such a dork. They use... I keep on forgetting Kinemon's friend's name. Painter Samurai guy. They use his power...
He's one of the characters I've least liked in One Piece recently. I only like that his fucking drawings all look like shit.
They use it to climb up on top of the elephant, and then they go and try to find their friends. We catch up with the Revolutionary Army for a bit as... I think this is like the longest conversation we've seen Dragon be involved in. It's quite a long and in-depth conversation he has with Koala.
Yeah. It's nice because we don't generally see him talking either. You know, his appearances in the series have been very few and far between, so this was sort of an interesting little thing. I really like that, you know, she asked, like, "Oh, aren't you going to ask about Luffy?" He's like, "No, I've already heard it enough about that. Like, oh, you must have heard from Sabo." I'm like, "Oh, aren't we? We're not going to get a moment of, like, Dragon, like, how's my son doing?"
Mm-hmm. Basically, Dragon congratulates them on the success of their operation. Koala mentions something called Drunken Iron Ore, a very special metal that only a few countries can produce. And she says that it's very important because, you know, they might be able to identify who is creating the weapons and so on. And at the end of the conversation, Dragon says, "We're going to need help for this. Call an assembly of all the revolutionary leaders throughout the world."
You know what this means, Nick?
No.
Big group scene with a bunch of new One Piece characters! Oh, well, and Ivankov. And I think maybe the other dude with the scissor hands. I guess he was maybe one, too.
We then meet another character. Basically... Oh, no, wait.
No, this is Shinryu of the Rain. This is the warden from Impel Down who joined up with Blackbeard's crew.
So they're called Emperors of the Sea.
Emperor of the Sea, Blackbeard Pirates. Blackbeard's Emperor of the Sea, and Shinryu is basically like his second captain, who captains one of his ships.
I thought that Black... Did
Blackbeard... Blackbeard's an emperor. He's one of the four emperors.
I thought he left the emperors.
No, he left the warlords.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. No, I'm caught up. I understand everything now.
Also, I like the little touch that all of Blackbeard's boat have big logs on the side, harkening back to the days when his ship was literally just a bunch of logs together and a fucking mast.
"Captain, I think this makes us very difficult to navigate. Shut up! Are you going to take it up with Blackbeard?" "No, sir."
I'm still wondering where the fuck San Juan Wolf is in all of this.
Okay. And where's their fucking doctor, too? That one weird guy with the horse.
Dr. Q?
Yeah.
I imagine we'll see. Well, Samwon Wolf is the fucking, the biggest character on One Piece. He's that dude who was, like, hiding behind the fucking, barely able to hide behind the fucking Marine HQ. He was that big. I want to know how the fuck you transport that around.
So, like, I walk across the ocean. So they get word from Burgess, and they're like, yeah, we went to Dressrosa for you, but you weren't there. Yeah, sorry about that. Basically it. He says, I'm in a white place, an island all in white, and I snuck into the bilge of a ship. So tell Captain Teach to attack this place at once, and we can get a ton of weapons, which implies that it might be that special metal place that Koala and Dragon might be talking about. Yeah, maybe.
No, it's
or it could be.
It's their the place where Dragon and them are.
Oh,
it's the same place, the Revolutionary Headquarters.
Well, this is bad, isn't it? I didn't even realize that. Shit.
Yeah, no, he's at the Revolutionary Headquarters outside of it. Because he even says it, I found the headquarters of the Revolutionary
Army. Oh, yeah, he says it's where you'll find Dragon and that hateful Sabo.
Did you miss that panel?
Yes, I did. Okay. I completely forgot about it. But he's got a beaver card on him so they can track him down. And then we get to... Okay, so... We get to Buggy Town! Where... Buggy is making an appearance. He's got this... I can only imagine he's using his power to separate his hands from his body and then, like, attached a blanket to them so he could look really big.
Oh, yeah. That is absolutely what he's doing.
What an asshole. So he's like, oh, now the Doflamingo isn't supplying the weapons anymore. They're all begging for pirate mercenaries. We've got a monopoly on the fighting business. And so he's like, yeah, it's time to go raise hell and pillage and so on. Every act of piracy you commit under the name of Buggy, the genius jester, becomes the legal business of a warlord of the sea. Yeah, ha, 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 ha. And everyone's chanting his name and so on and so forth. Yeah. Good job, Buggy. Although he gets word that, oh, hey, we got a message from Hydrogen. He's quitting the company. Actually, also, four more giants are going with them. Yeah, no, all five of them are gone, too. Well, those are our biggest breadwinners! And just the start of our business season! Why? Well, I don't think you want to know. Tell me!
It's because of Luffy. Like, ah, damn it!
Poor Buggy. Why am I talking about poor Buggy? He's a fucking warlord. Never mind.
Yeah, and yeah, it's kind of cool. We get to see his, like, his group behind him. Mr. Three stayed with him. That's kind of cool.
And also, he's mastering his cult of personality, his presentations, and so on and so forth. Is that Alvida there?
Yeah, Alvida's there. Kabaji.
She stole a hat from Caitlyn, apparently.
Yeah.
Then we cut back to Zoe with Luffy's group, going up the elephant's leg, and they're like, it's getting tired for some reason. Like, yeah, whatever. Okay. Yeah. Anyhow, Kinemon's friend eventually says, when we first left Wano, it was Zoe that was our destination. We want to know that Momonosuke is safe, and that our other companion, Lost at Sea, has arrived here as well. The ninja, Raizo! And they're immediately like, you have a ninja? And Luffy's eyes are glinting. He's like, I haven't seen a ninja yet. Fuck yeah. But then they see something that's flying towards them up from above. But we aren't going to get to find out what it is for another couple of weeks as One Piece is off next week.
That's a bummer. But what do you do? As long as we have World Trigger next week, I'm fine.
Yes, and we do. So. What do you think is flying towards them, Chris?
Sanji.
Why is Luffy saying, what the heck is that, then?
Recognize Sanji. He grew his beard out a little bit.
He looks like that original Wanted poster now.
Yeah, he's like, that's not Sanji. Sanji's thing was on the other side. Like, there was a time skip, Luffy. You forgot it. Like, oh...
Right.
I forgot the part changed.
Okay. So just kind of a bit more of a catch-up around the world in One Piece, and yeah, that's that.
Some cool details, yeah. Toriko. Yeah.
Toriko. I did not understand what happened in this chapter.
So essentially, it's follow-up of last time, like, Toriko's woken up, and the way it's portrayed to us is, like, we go back to when Toriko... was pre-time skip, and Toriko first went into the gourmet world to bring back Komatsu. And they know that, you know, during the time, it was when he was emitting his strongest aura because he had the strongest motivation, finally. And that's why he was able to get into the gourmet world at that time. He was able to chase all these routes. He was able to find Komatsu. Monsters didn't attack him. And even Midoriya said the same thing. Like, oh, if back then... if I had not so easily handed the boy over to him, what do you suppose would have happened, Star? And, you know, he
know, it's like, it, you know, you probably wouldn't have gotten off as easily as you did because he had that much determination and resolution, though I don't know how much of it he is aware of himself. Like, he basically wasn't even aware how strong he was, and then he really kept going, and, you know, maybe it would have been a really crazy thing.
Because love is the strongest force in the universe, Chris.
Platonic love between
platonic
men.
Platonic want to eat food together and grow old together so they can eat more food.
But very platonically, they may be in rocking chairs next to each other. But they're
both
holding
hands. Dorka's got a fiance now.
Yeah, so they're not gay, but the best friends.
Komatsu's got two female love interests now.
So they know, like, you know, he's like, oh, I can smell it. And basically, just blah, 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 blah. All the foods are awakening. I'm knowing it. I'm getting the same sense from you, Battle Wolf, but you're not actually one of the eight kings, Battle Wolf. The real one's right there, and we see Battle
and it looks
Wolf.
Way less cool than the Battle Wolf we thought was the eighth king.
But he does have a much cooler name, because Guinness is an awesome name for a dog. But blah, blah, blah. They basically just have a little bit about, like, oh, they're, you know, it woken up a bunch of powers in Toriko, and, what, you know, two big things are about to collide. But then all of a sudden, Toriko gets a call from Komatsu, and he gets super excited. He actually punches the Battle Wolf in the face, which is kind of weird, but he gets a call from Komatsu, and he's super excited. He's like, oh, how are things going on your end? And this is the thing that's confusing, because Komatsu's like, we did it! We got another! And you're like, fine, we skipped that arc. I guess we just got that one thing with Yuta, where he killed a dude, and we just cut through the rest of it. But everyone else has changed dramatically enough that I feel like it was supposed to represent the large amount of time passed. Because Komatsu's hair is really long.
He doesn't just have longer hair. His hair is hanging down to knee level.
Yeah, like, Rin has longer hair. The fucking oil guy has lost weight and grown like a fucking long fucking mustache. Everyone looks older as though an inordinate amount of time has passed. Where I wasn't sure if this was supposed to suggest that if it's, you know, like, okay, a long, like, a time skip has happened, or if it's just like, no, this is Toriko. A lot of fucking foods they eat just do wacky shit, so it's like, no, we, like, all took a bite of another, and, like, holy shit, my, you know, we all got older looking, or all of our hair grew. I don't know exactly what it's supposed to be. It's confusing. The other thing is that we see Big Dawn Slime actually looking like a person. They're like, oh, don't drop the Dawn. Oh, forget it. It'd be better if you just thought of me as a disaster. Except I'm a natural disaster, just brimming with ill will. And Don Slime, as we know, was not Acacia. What was his name?
Ichiru's
demon. So he's, like, actually hanging out and chatting with people.
Yeah.
Again, it'd be fine if it wouldn't, if it explained maybe what was going on here, but a lot of people shit on this chapter so much, like the people who read the Scanlations for it last week. I really didn't see the problem with this chapter. It's not good. I wasn't like, what a great Toriko chapter. I was like, it works fine. It's nice that they actually stuck to one storyline for once instead of being like, yeah, I know Toriko woke up last chapter, but let's go see what Sunny and crew are up to.
It's kind of about what I've come to expect from Toriko, which is, a lot of shit happened, and I didn't understand much of it. It was muddled and weird. Mm-hmm. That's about it.
That's really all.
Whatever. Alright. World Trigger, Chapter 118, Chika Amatori, Part 5. So, Osamu and Yuma and Chika have all arrived at Border Headquarters. I always forget this guy's name. Is it Kinuta?
I think Kinuta. Kinuta. Or Kinuta.
So Yuma and Osamu are like, hey, we would like to talk with Inadora. And Kinuta's like, don't interfere in our business! But he takes them to Inadora anyway. And Inadora's hanging out in this little cushion, and he's like, I've already told you everything. You know, it's gonna be one of those two, you know, places that's going to come and attack. That's all I've got. And I'm tired. Go away. And he's like shooing them away with one of his weird little crab metal claws. And so, like, we don't really know anything else about this. And Kinuta's like, come on, give us more details. Ryzo, do something! And Ryzo, the large engineer, is like, okay. Goes to Andor and he's like, come on. I'll show you another movie. So he was showing him T2 last week.
He was. Also, I think that this is the one, like, of all of Border, like, I know that the Zoe was kind of fat, but this dude, like, literally fucking waddles. Like, of all this, like, this organization of all these pretty boys, this is the one, like, kind of frumpy dude.
So, Inanora kind of says the same thing, but he's a bit more upfront about it. He's like, look, working the outskirts is for small fry. It's not my job. They're both inconsequential, puny countries. Meaden somehow outlasted our attack, so they shouldn't be able to catch you with your pants down. And Yuma says, well, Enadorad isn't lying for what it's worth. What'd you call me, you albino shrimp? It's like such a catch. It's not even bad. He just adds a D onto his name. He's so pissed off about it. God. Kinoda kind of spills some of the beans about what's going on for some reason. And he's like, yeah, we kind of know what's going on. They're trying to carry out a secret defense, but you guys are close enough to it that I'll let you in on this, basically. They're trying to make sure that they can defend the city without a lot of people learning about it, basically. Yuma eventually says, look, by the way, how do you know that these countries are coming to attack? And Inadora says, well, do I need a reason? I just know that Hyrene would do it, and that's all. Hyrene, of course, being the Aftokrator captain, as Osama helpfully reminds us. And he says, yeah, well, you know, that guy would send his minions at you at this point, because it would be a real drag to him if Meaden came after Aftokrator. And they're like, well, but they came here to capture people with high Trion, so wouldn't it be convenient for them if we went after them and, you know, gave them the chance to get more captures? And Inadora says, well, no. Once they get back, there'll be some infighting to choose gods. They can't afford to be dealing with outside forces. One piece of warning. It'll be better not to tell Husei about this plan. He might be behaving now, but I bet he's waiting for his chance to return home. And someone just kind of says, can you elaborate on that? So, maybe he's come up with a way to convince Husei in order to join their team, basically.
Yeah, it seems like he's basically got the motivation now. Husei mm-hmm. wants to return home, now he can use it as a way to kind of like, hey, we can get you home.
Mm-hmm. So, we cut to Chika's training exercise, which is basically just a bunch of snipers trying to out-camp each other. They're trying to score points for getting hits and avoid getting hit as well, because you lose points if you do that. It's specifically like 5 points for each hit you earn and -2 for each time you get hit. And also, the guns don't make any sound, they don't cause any damage or anything. So, and I think that there's a moment where, because you fucking Yuzuru, that's his name, it seems as though he deliberately leaves himself open for Chika to shoot him. I think. That's the impression that I got. Because we see at the end, he only got hit twice, and once, presumably, was by the ace of the class, Isami. So I got the impression that he, I guess, was just trying to... Because he says to himself, oh, so she can shoot in training. So I think that he deliberately left himself open so that he would see if Chika actually shot him.
Very possible.
That was what I got. But after Chika scores the hit... she immediately gets hit from 600 meters away. She's like, what the fuck?
A headshot from 600 meters away mid-jump.
Yeah.
She's like, what kind of bullshit character match? Oh, Toma, okay.
Oh, it's so we actually cut to basically every single sniper that we've met so far in the series, basically. We see that Chika did fairly well for herself. She got 19th place. Izuho got 64th place, it looks like. And I like how as soon as she has exited the class, the cat's coming up to her.
That cat's something big. I feel it. That cat is going to turn out to be a neighbor.
Oh, God. I like the line that someone has. Izuho, you're full of holes. You're so popular.
But I do like, because Toma didn't go for easy kills, but he got her. So clearly she has some sort of moderate karma talent, you know?
Well, she got more kills than deaths, at the very least.
Yeah, so she ended up positive. Yeah.
And Chika did really well. She only got hit three times, but she got 22 kills, which is actually more than a lot of the top people did. And actually, the top person in the class was...
She did better than Emma, actually.
Oh, yeah, and she also did better than Toma because he only killed 12 people, even though he didn't get hit once. So a lot of people who were way more aggressive got more points. So, like, Toru Narasaka got first place, but guess who was the one who got the one kill on him? So it's another one of those things where it's like, yeah, Yuzuru and Toma are basically the best in the class, but they just don't score well because they don't really feel like they have to try hard.
Also, I love that Satori, Arashiyama squad sniper, the double sniper guy, got second.
Yeah.
And I like to just think he runs around just firing a sniper.
I've got two snipers!
Look what I did! Two sniper arrows!
It doesn't matter if I get hit by everyone, if I hit everyone else.
You see, he got a few pot shots on him, so maybe that is a strategy.
He's got one on his cheek, a few on his sleeves, but yeah, that's a really high score, too. So, and then, yeah, they're like, oh, yeah, Chika, you did really well. You know, we're in the top fifth of the class, and Yuzuru's giving her a nice congratulation, but he says, you know, you do better in combat simulations than in target practice, so that's unusual. And Chika says, well, my teacher taught me how to hide, so, you know, maybe it's easier for me to tell whether snipers might be hiding. And I love this little back and forth, because Izuho is like, well, you got me, too. She takes the can and just dumps it on Chica's head.
I like to think the cat's angry, too. Like, this isn't my home.
This isn't my
home. This isn't my head.
This isn't my seat. I'm going to shit all over it. So Yuzuru just thinks to himself, so she does have a mentor. That's kind of a waste. Well, she can do so well, so she should have been able to score a bunch of points in those matches. So just kind of learning at his own rate what Chika, you know, what her troubles are because he's outside of the squad's network of information and stuff. But I like that he doesn't just think of the match that he was involved in. He thinks of the two matches that they had before they went up against his squad as well, which means that he's actually been watching Tamakoma 2's progress. Mm-hmm. I always forget her name and I have to go back. Izuho is like, hey, you know, Chika, you should get her to teach you how to shoot people. And Chika's like, oh. Or Yuzuru is like, oh, you know, too. Chika says, well, my teacher said, flashback, you know, we all know you trained very hard, so don't blame yourself too much. It's actually normal not to be able to shoot people. You'll slowly have to get used to it if you want to fight. But I know I have to do something about it soon, because at this rate, I won't be very helpful to the team. And Yuzuru thinks of, and I think that we're supposed to know who this is. Is this the guy who transforms into the monster? It looks like his hairstyle to me.
No, that's, what's her name? The chicken disappeared.
Of course, the girl who didn't want to shoot people, too. Yeah. He, of course, thinks of her, and he's, you know, thinking, oh, I'm useless, I'm sorry, and stuff. And so Yuzuru says, hey, can you come with me for a bit, because I might be able to help. And then he proceeds to start putting the moves on her, you know.
Yeah, he's like, yeah.
I'm sorry, out of all of the people, the couples that get ship teased in this series, this one seems like the most obvious to me.
What about Kisamu, Nick?
I know that one, but that one's a bit more of like the, you know, oh, Sunsun, but the weird he's, you know, faceted on her kind of thing. It's just like, he seems obsessed with her, right?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. He's got a little crush, you know. He wants to get in.
So long as he's not like, I'll show you what sniper rifle you can shoot.
He's like, Anubis!
You can shoot me.
I didn't get you during the practice match! No, God damn it, did she not get any pickup lines?
I'm 13. Oh!
Wow, that old? Oh. Alright, well.
I don't even know how old I'm supposed to be, because Nick's forgotten my age. If it's been stated at all.
I feel like it's 15, 14.
He doesn't seem like he's much older than her now.
He seems like around the same height. I think that he's supposed to be like around the same age. This is a big Chika chapter, Nick. We get a lot from this, and I'm very excited for this, because for a very long time I have not given the slightest of fucks about Chika. I've always thought, like, hey, who really cares? This first chapter kind of made me think, like, oh, like, this is actually a pretty cool character, because she's a very quiet character. It's not like Osamu, where we get a lot of chapters where it's, you know, introspective into what he wants to do. But we see a lot about this. I'm impressed with the fact that Chika got 19th in the sniper contest, because her big draw is that she's the Trion powerhouse. She can fire so much. But the fact that in a contest that had nothing to do with her Trion abilities,
She got 19th out of all snipers, including A-ranks. That's very impressive for her. Like, that was something I was like, that's a pretty huge deal. And, you know, the way she goes on to explain, like, you know, I know to hide, like, I know that, so that's kind of what makes it a little bit easier for me to find maybe where all the other snipers are. And then, you know, a little bit with Renji just talking, like, it's actually normal for you to not be able to shoot people. That's something you kind of had to learn how to do. Like, it's just small little touches like that that have gotten me into it, and I'm invested into Chica now, and I'm like, I do want to see this character grow, and I'm super excited for this. And I feel like that last hang-up, Nick, that was over me on World Trigger, I feel like it's slightly releasing, and I am going to say something very bold, Nick.
What's that?
This might be my favorite manga, even over One Piece, as of right now. I feel like a passing of the torch has just gone. Like, Luffy has stretched his arm out with the torch. Osamu grabbed it, dropped it, because he's clumsy, but he fumbled it in midair.
He had Yuma there to look out for him.
Yuma slapped it back up, and then Osamu grabbed it. He dropped it again because he grabbed the hot hand.
So Chica caught it then.
Yeah, Chica caught it, handed it to him. And he's holding it.
And he dropped it one more time, and Kitora slapped him on the back of the head. You fuck up, come on.
Then they started banging, because this is a scenario of World Trigger
this
of my
is
creation.
This is the greatest passing of the torch scene ever.
Anyway, eventually they stapled it to his hand. And now he has it. But I love World Trigger right now. And maybe it's because I'm also going through the volumes right now, and they're so enjoyable to kind of read through it again, but I sincerely am really enjoying World Trigger right now. All the characters in it, everything in it, I'm highly enjoying it.
I think the time is going to tell, because remember, it did take us a long time to actually come around to the series, and it could very well end up sticking into a half-year-long or whatever quagmire of boring shit. Because, you know, sometimes series just go in cycles like that, where they, you know, hit their peaks and troughs and stuff. I mean, I've liked World Trigger for a very long time, though. It feels like. Oh, how long is this now? This has been like something like 2 straight years where it's been consistently good. Mm-hmm. Like really good. So, I mean, yeah, it's been good. It's been consistently good. And I totally understand that, because One Piece is such a series that, because it's such a tremendous epic of a story, there can be times when it kind of has to take a breather and not a lot of interesting stuff is really happening because things need to be spaced out more. And you have such high expectations for it that sometimes it doesn't always hit those. Whereas World Trigger, it still feels like a new experience that you're going along with. So I totally understand that.
Yeah. I'm not guaranteeing it. I haven't read through a lot of the old One Piece volumes yet. So all I can say is I'm definitely enjoying it more than like current One Piece, even as much as I love it. But this is a chapter I was like, I guess I really, really fucking love this series. And I'm like, oh, finally Chica's gaining a moment. This is a character I've given none of a shit about for so long. Also, that cat totally is evil. No, I'm not guaranteeing it.
Look at that little guy.
I feel like I don't know how to put
having that blank stare. Being a selfish cat, but he's cuddly, so you forgive it. You know what he's thinking of right now. He's just like, why is the short one handling me? And if she is handling me, why is my face not shoved in a bowl full of fish right now? I want to go back to my perch where I can observe my kingdom.
Two things. One, I feel like I want to put like a $5 bet down or some bet that if this cat turns out to be evil, I get something, because I feel like when it happens, I want to be like, I was there. Second, if this were a pug, you would hate it.
Yes, I would.
You'd be like, fuck that stupid ass dog.
And so we come full circle from Nick hating dogs. That is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. A good goddamn discussion this week on Monster. Lots of good chapters in the recap, so thank you so much for joining us. I loved doing this episode in particular. It's a pretty long one, but thankfully we did not quite hit 3 hours yet.
We're 3 hours streaming, so we really gotta wrap this up, though.
Let's do it. Thank you for joining us here on twitch.tv/RoloT. We normally stream Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also follow us on Twitter for updates, just in case we do need to change the recording time. He is at RoloT. I'm at YRuler of Time. Chris also runs the @WMRBodcast for manga-specific tweets. You can follow that as well. Check out past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, and also subscribe to us on iTunes. Plus, leave a comment and rating so we can beat the woodworking podcasts.
Which no one did, so I'm pretty bummed about
so
that.
So fuck all of you.
Yeah, you guys really let me down this week. I was expecting to pop in. Some guy's like, I'm here to help you beat the woodworkers. Nobody.
Be sure to send Crazy some questions for us to ask on a future episode and also suggestions for us to read in the future. Put them in an email and send them to us. weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com is the address. Special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We're up to 3 bonus things a month now, and we're going to be recording those for October very soon. Also, special thanks go out to Steve Man, our Talcarice. You can check out his work at neuroticfanboy.deviantart.com, idropboobs.tumblr.com, patreon.com/Steve Man, and other places as well. Also, special thanks to the infamous Planet, as well as Felix Dark, for creating visual editions of the show.
And I just want to give a special thanks, by the way, to Benjamin Adams for recently pledging to our Patreon. It is greatly appreciated, good sir.
Also, we need to decide a couple of things. For one thing, we have to figure out what movie we're going to do for the special movie commentary stream, our first one they're going to be doing. If you have suggestions for that, you can also send them those to us. Also, we are, for our bonus episode, going to be doing live readings of some chapters. I believe we are still kind of open on what chapters we're going to be doing for that.
Yeah, I might, because we aren't getting people suggesting ones specifically. What I may do is I may create a poll of like significant chapters over the past month, like maybe at least one from each series, post those up in a straw poll, and then let people vote that way.
So closely follow Twitter so that you can be updated on that in case there is something that you want to voice your opinion on. Mm-hmm. And that's that. So, Chris, what are we going to be reading for the next series in Halloween month?
All right, Nick. This is an odd one because it's almost like a pick between us, because I have 2 series I'm considering. I'm going to let you make the decision on it, on which one. So both of these are series that are highly requested from us for Halloween month or outside of it. One of them is a more traditional horror. It's specifically a horror series. It is a series that is meant to scare you. It is meant to cause psychological distress. It is meant to be a disturbing series. The second one is a monster-themed kind of series. It plays into themes of monsters, demons, Satan, those kinds of characters. But it's a more traditional shonen series with those elements to it. More lighthearted, though still not being lighthearted completely. It's still a serious series. But it's between those two. One that's more of like a... maybe closer to like a Soul Eater, and then maybe one that's closer to like a Tomei or something like that.
I say let's do the horror series.
Okay. All right, then. So next week but 2 weeks, maybe we'll see. Our next series for Halloween month will be Parasite.
Oh, I've already read that.
I have to, so...
That's more shonen action-y than you may suspect.
The other one was a lot more short and action-y, so I think this one at least has horror elements.
Be sure to look out for it next time as we encounter a series full of body horror, messed up crazy people, and latent sexism.
Oh, exciting. Speaking of sexism, Nick.
Oh, no.
yeah, is that like, to me, the worst segue someone get? I recently saw a tweet, and I'm posing this sort of to you, but also to our female correspondent, Derek. I saw leggings that were made for, like, that resemble, like, Horde armor from World of Warcraft. And I've seen these a lot of times. I've seen them for, like, Mass Effect characters. Like, leggings that look like they're meant to resemble, like, character outfits from video games. Does anyone ever wear these?
I don't fucking know geek fashion. People wear weird shit.
But I'm like, leggings
are like... Look at this weird thing I made. It reminds you of this series because I designed it off of that. And then people buy them. And I see it on Tumblr. There you go. People make stupid clothes out of geeky stuff. Now, excuse me, I'm going to go wear my sweater that makes me look like R2-D2.
Bye, everybody.